You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great pleasure to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio Dave Lindorf. Dave Lindorf is an investigative reporter and one of the best of them. He writes for The Nation, for the London Review of Books, for Salon, for Tarbell.org. He is founder of the collectively run journalists' news site, which I highly recommend, which is called ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. Dave Lindorf, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
David, I'm honored. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. Had to invite you back on after seeing this article you'd written for The Nation magazine called The Pentagon's Massive Accounting Fraud Exposed, which sadly doesn't sound like news. It sounds like, you know, a story we've all seen 1,800 times. I mean, seriously, that's one's first impression, but it actually is bigger and more outrageous, if that's possible, than past stories of this sort. Can you give us an outline of what's new here?
Yeah, what I found out, I was asked to do this story by the investigations editor at The Nation, Mark Hertzgard, who and said, you know, there's this $21 trillion in missing Pentagon money story that's floating around on the internet, and what about finding out what that is? What's that about? And I had written once about how it wasn't being covered by the mainstream media for fear, but other than that, I hadn't looked at it. And what I found out is that it's not secret money flowing to the Pentagon, which was what was kind of people were suspecting, and probably why the mainstream media was ignoring the story, because that's just too weird to imagine. We wouldn't have had a recession if that
real,
was that kind of if that kind of money were flowing into the Pentagon, we wouldn't have had a recession.
The real story is pretty darn weird too.
I know, it is weird. So what I found out is that these are numbers that are made up by the Pentagon each year by the army of bookkeepers and accountants. They're mostly based in Indianapolis, Indiana, at the Defense Finance Accounting Service that does most of the Pentagon's books. And they have terminology they use there that I discovered called plugs and nippering that are how they make these numbers up to sort of make what the current year's budget comes out as match the prior year's ending budget, like the starting budget of one and the ending one of the last one. And they call them plugs. And they can be really enormous. And then the nippering is where they will – that's a tool. A nipper is a tool that snips metal. And so they nipper budget funds that weren't spent and move them into different classifications where they can't be found, and instead of returning them to the Treasury as required by the Constitution and by congressional law. So there's this whole thing going on, and you would say, well, why are they doing this? And the reason is, and let me give you an example first. The Army budget in 2015 was $122 billion. In their review of the Army budget that the Defense Department's own internal monitor, the Office of Inspector General, did that year. They monitor various selected parts of the Pentagon budget each year and issue a report on it in which they say that it's full of crap, basically, with made-up numbers. They call it unsupported adjustments is the term the OIG uses. They looked at this Army budget, and they found a number for accounts payable, which is money owed to contractors and, you know, outside agencies, of 900 and I think it was $917 or something billion dollars, right? So the Army has a $122 billion budget, but it has a $917 billion accounts payable total. And then they also listed a, and this is where people get suspicious, right? A $724 billion cash dispersal from the Treasury, which would be like totally illegal, because that would be unappropriated funds that Congress hadn't authorized. And both those numbers were the OIG just, you know, blithely said these are unsupported adjustments, meaning that there were no ledger entries to support that money.
So it was just plugged in. The Army gets $100 billion and then has $700 billion. Why isn't that just a religious miracle?
Yeah, well, it would be if it was real money, but it's a plug. Both of those numbers are plugs, and that's a real classic example of what's going on. And then that year, there was a total of $6.5 trillion in plugs in the 2015 budget, which was only about $500 and something billion that year in total from Congress.
And so the reason for all of this is not to pretend they have money they don't have and get themselves less money. There's a broader reason for this.
Yeah. What I discovered is, and I was told this by a number of people who have been insiders and are now retired or from the guy that oversees the GAO's monitoring of the Pentagon budget, and currently works there and talked to me on the record, is that they basically are doing two things. They're, number one, they're making the Pentagon budget completely indecipherable, which is why the Pentagon audit that was finally mandated and funded at $900 million was a complete failure. The audit firms walked away from it and said, we can't do it. So that's one effect of it. So nobody can really monitor, you know, the press, the Congress. Nobody can monitor what kind of spending is going on at the Pentagon. And probably even some of the leadership of the Pentagon can't know what's going on. So that's all to the good from the Pentagon's point of view, as long as nobody calls them on it. And the second thing is that they're able to present financial statements for the current year and the prior fiscal year, so in this case 2018 and 2017, that inflate the spending that they've actually done, so that when Congress looks at the prior years and the military says, or the Pentagon brass tells them, you know, this is what we spent and we need more, the Congress just dutifully says, oh, that makes sense, and they give them more. So it's sort of counterintuitive, you know, by making it look like they spend more, they get to ask for more.
But this is not just you speculating. You've got people involved in this in your article.
On the record, yeah.
On the record, saying essentially, saying specifically, literally, that when the Pentagon presents a budget to the Congress, it simply makes up fictional numbers.
Well, the best quote was from the guy, Jack Armstrong, who was a retired supervisory audit director for the Pentagon's Office of Inspector General. And he said basically that the Pentagon is making up the numbers and they should just go to Congress and say the documents we're giving you are just garbage. And that was the term he used. the takeaway of this is that if this were any other government agency and the same thing happened and the books were garbage, it would be banner headlines in all the major dailies and it would be the lead story in most of the network news.
And there would be actual action from the Congress. The agency would be shut down.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, imagine if it were Health and Human Services or Education Department or EPA or you know, any of those agencies that that you know, the conservatives and neoliberals and everybody love to hate, they would strike out at it with, you know, hearings and you know, press conferences, expressing outrage, speeches on the floor. You know, it would be all over the place. But here we have the Pentagon just failed its first ever full audit. I mean, and, you know, we had Undersecretary Shanahan come out on a press conference and say, we failed, but we should get credit for having, you know, even attempted to do this. And I wrote, you know, in my piece, well, yeah, except for the fact that, and nobody in the press wrote this, except for the fact that you've been deliberately stonewalling for 26 years in order to do just this. So why should they get credit at all? But well, the point is that if you have the largest line item budget entity in the government completely fail an audit so badly that they couldn't just do the audit and include a comment letter, but they couldn't even do the audit, then there should be moonshot headlines on the New York Times. Pentagon fails first audit, right? It isn't even a page one story.
It's incredible. So just to back up for 1 second and try to get something clear, Dave Lindorf, this figure of $21 trillion, what is that? Is that an estimate of the amount of money that nobody can figure out what the Pentagon—
It's not an estimate. It's actual numbers. There's a Professor Mark Skidmore did this yeoman's job with two of his doctoral students at Michigan State University. He's a public accounting professor who got onto this story, and he sicked his students, and he and they went on to the OIG's website where they looked at all the reports back to, I think, he said it was, they went back as far as 1998 and looked at the reports, which are actually online, of the various units of the Pentagon budget that were reviewed by the OIG, and they tallied up all of the enormous plugs that they found in those budgets that were highlighted by the OIG each time. And so actually, there are probably lots more plugs because the Pentagon is not totally reviewed by the OIG in any year. It only, like, 1 year they'll do the Marines, 1 year they'll do the Navy, 1 year they'll do the Army, 1 year they'll do the Air Force, and so you're not getting the full picture.
Okay, but this is made up numbers.
Bigger.
This is a figure calculating a total of made up numbers. What if we try to guesstimate or know specifically how much money the Pentagon has stashed away that it can have been doing or could be doing, God knows what it wants with, off the record, off the books, secret piles of money? How much money is that?
Well, that was a hard one for me to get because nobody really knows. I mean, that's part of the advantage of hiding money, is that you can't find it. But I'll tell you what I was told. Several people speculated that it's at least $100 billion of a slush fund that gets built up through this nippering process of moving unspent funds, because they're not spending all the money each year that they say they are. And if that's true, they're moving some of it that should have been returned to the Treasury they're tucking it away into other places. And the way they do that is, the biggest way they do that, I'm told, is to illegally convert what they call one-year money, money that's appropriated and expected to be spent within the year, the budget year, and should, if it's not spent, be returned to the Treasury. They convert it into what's called five-year money, which is program money for things like weapons systems or construction projects and things like that. And five-year money doesn't have to be returned for the length of the five-year project. And then they can keep nippering that away to other, you know, projects along the way. And as one guy who had spent years as an accountant at the Pentagon said, you can nipper things four, five, six times until the money's completely lost and untraceable.
So that's
what they do.
I think a lot of people have heard and have some awareness that the Pentagon in recent years has had this separate outside of its budget fund of extra money for wars, or what President Obama called overseas contingency operations.
Yeah,
right?
That's just to keep it off of the budget number to make the budget look smaller.
Right. So to try to finish that question, so that some people are aware of, that there's tens of billions, $100 billion a year put into that slush fund that gets moved into who knows what spending. But this is separate from that. This is just within the regular so-called non-war Pentagon budget. There's this creation of a slush fund through lies about what any money is going to.
Yeah, and there's a precedent for this. I was talking with Chuck Spinney, who was famous for having exposed, on the record whistleblower, who was famous for exposing Pentagon fraud and waste during the 80s. And actually, times being different back then, he was actually made Man of the Year for his efforts. You know, imagine that today. What he told me was that back in his day, in the 80s, he and some of his other whistleblowers, Ernie Fitzgerald and others, found that the Pentagon was doing something sort of similar. They were grossly overestimating the inflation factor to add to their budget requests. And you may recall, you're probably old enough to recall the hyperinflation in the early Reagan years.
Sure.
And that's when they started doing it. So they would put in, instead of putting in, 12 or 15% inflation adjustment, which was what was happening at the time, they did a 30% inflation adjustment. And for a number of years, they were allowed to get away with that. And then, of course, it wouldn't come in at that amount. And so they would have a lot of money left over for, things like weapons development and stuff like that, because of these inflation adjustments in all their budget categories. And that money, which should have been returned to the Treasury as unspent, was shifted into something that I think originally it was called the M Fund. And then it changed into something called the Merged Surplus Account.
Yeah.
I guess it was an M account and then a merged surplus account. And nobody really knew what that was. The eyes just glazed over and went past it. But it actually came to reach something like $50 billion, which in today's money is $100 billion. So that's a lot of money. And Spinney said that he and Fitzgerald and some other experts were pretty sure that a lot of that went towards the Iran-Contra program.
Yeah.
So, in other words, this stuff is available now for black projects that are even sometimes outside of the purview of the senior leadership of the Pentagon, I think.
Right. So there's no need to go sell guns secretly to Iran or some other place, more likely
to sell
Iran's
drugs
neighbors.
To Los Angeles.
Right. Or to sell cocaine on the streets. There's no need. It might be done anyway, but there's no need because there's this slush fund created by budgeting.
Just to give you an indication that this may be like really nefarious and outside of control, and where even Mattis may not know about it, is that back in 2001 on September 10th, which people may notice the date there, in 2001, there was a press conference held by Don Rumsfeld, who was the micromanaging Secretary of Defense under Bush and Cheney. He held a press conference and said that, my people have found, my office has found that there's $2.3 trillion of untraceable financial transactions in the Pentagon. And he said this is, he darkly intoned that, the enemy is not Russia or China, it's the Pentagon bureaucracy. And he called it a life and death matter to find out where that money is, right?
Was that in and, 1 year or decade or who knows?
He wasn't clear. It appears that it was in 1 year what he was talking about when you go back and look.
So I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is another question I have. How do you take an agency that gets several hundred billion dollars a year and refer to it, as they do in a quote in your article, as a $2.7 trillion organization, and according to Donald Rumsfeld, refer to over $2 trillion unaccounted for in its budget in 1 year? This is remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, well, people should be asking questions about that, and they never do. Even today, even Grassley, who knows about this stuff, has been railing at the Pentagon and raking them over the coals in hearings, budget hearings, for not complying with the Pentagon's congressional requirement to have an auditable budget. But he's not railing about the plugs. And I think that the only thing I can come up with is that it's such a wacky set of numbers that people in the mainstream media and people in Congress are afraid they'll be labeled, you know, tinfoil hat conspiracy theorists if they talk about it. And it certainly is true that, you know, the articles I was reading in the alternative media about this $21 trillion, and even Mark Skidmore himself, have not helped things by trying to say that it may be secret money flowing to the Pentagon, because that's just inconceivable. It wouldn't be possible without having observable impacts of that kind of spending. But the other thing is that that it's on both sides of the ledger, so it kind of cancels itself out. It's not all money coming in. It's money coming in and money going out, like that $900 billion and $700 billion. That sort of nets out to close to the $122 billion budget.
But, you know, I've met quite a few Congress members and congressional committee staff and former congressional committee staff, and I may find many of them engaged in immoral behavior that I could never justify, but I find some of them to be fairly intelligent. And if a couple of grad students can notice that $100 billion has turned into $700 billion, is it really conceivable that Congress doesn't know that the budgets it's being presented with are fabricated, are fiction?
Well, let me give you an example of how this works. I wanted to have Bernie Sanders comment on our article, which basically was written, and you know, most of the pieces were in it by early September, and so you know, the Nation said, you know, my editor is an excellent editor, Mark Hertzgard. I had a great time working with him. He said, well, look, the Nation's got good connections with Sanders, you know, and we got John Nichols, who's like really close to Sanders, and you know, we'll get you Sanders. He's very confident. We'll get you Sanders. Never got him. He never would respond to inquiries, even though apparently I'm told that John Nichols, you know, requested specifically that he talk with me. And yeah, and you know, I was saying nice things about Bernie during his primary, so no, he didn't want to get into this. I also discovered late in the game that Beto O'Rourke was on the House Armed Services Committee during his first term. He's still on it. So I called his office in Washington a week before the article came out, and when his campaign was over, and also his main office in Texas. And I left messages. I couldn't get through. I left messages saying that I was doing this story and wanted to get his comment on it. No callback, not even from the press person. So, you know, people are dodging this story and not doing their jobs.
As you know, we both signed an open letter last week to Senator Bernie Sanders that people can go and read and sign at worldbeyondwar.org/Bernie Bernie and asking him to mention the military once in a while, to not write books and give speeches and come up with 10-point plans that ignore the existence of 96% of humanity. So, and this, if you've seen the current draft of the Green New Deal coming out of Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others, it doesn't mention the top damager of the natural environment because it is the military. So this is a problem across the board. But let's we have just a few minutes left. Let's fantasize. What if it weren't? What if it were possible to deal with a budget with an agency that doesn't do audits as if it were any other agency? It seems that there's been lying to Congress, there's been fraud, there's been abuse of power. I mean, ought there not to be subpoenas, prosecutions, and impeachments?
Absolutely. This is so much bigger than Enron. It's like Enron on steroids. And, those guys went to jail. Nobody's been fired for putting plugs into the Pentagon budget that I can find. It's just they don't even get a slap on the wrist. It's just called out by the OIG, and then a lot of inspector generals. They have the authority to request a prosecution, and they've done it in many agencies over the years. Most of the inspector generals are pretty good. The response of this in Office of Inspector General, which is still headed by an acting director, by the way, under Trump, Glenn Fine, their response to Skidmore's research was to shut down the website. For a while, you couldn't see any of their reports. They've put it back up, but now when I looked at their latest review, which was the 2017 Navy budget, it's all blacked out. And that's a first. It was all censored. I have a FOIA request in to have it uncensored, but it's going nowhere. I had a background interview with the Undersecretary of Defense for Finance, his deputy, and it was all on background. But I mentioned to the guy that this document at the OIG's office was blacked out for the first time, and he said, "Oh, we'll look into that and get that corrected." But no, it hasn't been corrected.
In your article, Dave Lindorf, you mention Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. I mean, we've got just a minute left, but very briefly, what's the violation there?
It states very clearly that every agency in the government has to have a report annually on their budget filed with the Congress, and that all money has to be appropriated by Congress for the use that it's used for. So those two things are both being violated by the in spades by the Pentagon.
It is indeed. It's an incredible story. I highly recommend that people pick up The Nation magazine or go to thenation.com and look for this.
It's not in the current issue of The Nation magazine. It's in the next one coming out first week of December, but it is online.
Online at thenation.com. It's called Exclusive: The Pentagon's Massive Accounting Fraud Exposed by Dave Lindorf. And we have been speaking with Dave Lindorf, investigative reporter who writes for The Nation, the London Review of Books, Salon, Tarbell.org, and the website he is the founder of, thiscan'tbehappening.net. Dave Lindorf, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, early this year, Congress approved a budget of some $700 billion for the Department of Defense, more than the Trump administration even requested. Corporate media, for whom proposals like free college tuition or universal health care are all about the price tag, didn't even blink. The Pentagon budget was a rare act of bipartisanship, the New York Times told readers, that sets forth a muscular vision of America as a global power. That article had three sources, two approving state officials, and a rep from a think tank funded by defense contractors, who said the U.S. military is underfunded. The Times didn't find it relevant that the U.S. already spent more on defense than the next eight largest countries combined, six of whom are U.S. allies, and the idea of standing that $700 billion alongside the estimate of the U.N. and others that it would cost just $30 billion per year to end world hunger? Well, don't be silly. But if serious people are not supposed to consider Pentagon spending in any sort of context or conversation about priorities, can we at least ask why it's not just hard but impossible to find out how much the Pentagon spends and on what? Elite media reception of new research in that arena suggests they'd just as soon keep the whole thing under wraps, while reserving their right to entertain complaints about food stamps, however. We'll talk about Pentagon accounting and accountability with investigative reporter Dave Lindorf, author of that new expose, exclusive to The Nation magazine and the cover story in their new print edition. Lindorf is a veteran reporter and author and a founding member of the newspaper collective This Can't Be Happening. Pentagon fraud and what it means to all of us, coming up this week on Counterspin. But first, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. The Daily Beast saw itself scoring easy points off TV chat show The View, chiding hosts for disagreeing in a discussion of recently deceased former President George H.W. Bush. Quote, if there was one thing it seemed most Americans could agree on this weekend, it was that former President George H.W. Bush was generally a good man who had the country's best interest at heart. And yet, somehow, the hosts of The View still found a way to turn his tribute into an argument. Close quote. Well, thus sniffed the Daily Beast, which, like numerous other outlets that engaged in ingenuous whitewash of the former president, said more about itself than about anyone else. It isn't merely that it's no part of journalists' job to stoke misty visions of powerful public figures, dead or living. Asserting that George H.W. Bush was America's lovable grandpa, and that only the insolent would gainsay such an image, erases the many people harmed grievously by his actions and inactions. But those bombarded with corporate media accolades about how responsible and reasonable Bush Sr. was, according to the Washington Post, how he, in USA Today's words, personified a time when careful international diplomacy was not scorned as a sign of weakness, and how, as the Chicago Tribune had it, we were all touched by his modesty, seriousness, and gentlemanly grace. You could find their antidotes, not mean-spirited, but just clear-eyed, in alternative media. Mehdi Hassan at The Intercept ran down some of Bush Sr.'s war crimes, racism, and obstruction of justice. Bush campaign director Lee Atwater eventually apologized for that infamous Willie Horton ad. Bush never did. Richard Prince at Journalism's reminded of the Clarence Thomas appointment, as well as Bush's stage-managed setup of a D.C. teenager as the face of the crack epidemic. Stephen Thrasher at The Nation wrote about the disgrace of celebrating Bush on World AIDS Day, reminding of how he chided those dealing with the disease to just change your behavior. And The Nation's Greg Grandin reminded of Bush's wars in Panama and the Persian Gulf, both remarkable for gratuitous killing. Author Nora Eisenberg elaborated at Alternet on the myth of the good Gulf War and how Bush disinformed Congress and the public to drum up support for it. And before you get nostalgic for media coverage that never was, look through fair.org, and you'll find things like Robert McNeil of the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour demanding of a guest who insisted on talking in 1992 about the covert weapons pipeline set up to aid Nicaraguan Contras after Congress had prohibited direct government assistance, quote, "Why does this issue remain important? Clearly the public is bored with it. The polls all show that years ago they stopped being interested in it. Why not, as Mr. Bush describes in his pardon statement, why not bring in the healing power of the pardon and sweep it away and sweep the bitterness away?" Close quote. Of course, Bush Sr. did some important positive things. The Americans with Disabilities Act leaps to mind. But media who insist on sweeping away everything else, who reduce to a footnote all of those he harmed, are revealing their own view of what and who matters, which may not be history's and need not be our own. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. For those of us who remember the $640 toilet seat, the unbelievable absurdity of Pentagon spending has long been, while unbelievably absurd, taken for granted. The Department of Defense spends billions and billions on we know not what year after year. Tra-la. Elite media reported that Congress passed a $700 billion Pentagon bill, more than Trump even asked for, and that was a blip, unchallenged. Although the same press corps faced with a proposal for health care see themselves in the business of grilling proponents on how on earth they would pay for it. Pentagon spending is untethered, unaccountable. And no one complains too loudly because national security, magic words that shut down any critical conversation. But, you know, things are changing and people are reviving questions that have been shrugged or laughed off, like, why can't we know what the Defense Department is doing with what, if it were a matter of a few dollars for food stamps, would be importantly described as our taxpayer dollars? Our next guest has been examining that set of questions, resulting in an exclusive for The Nation magazine. The story's called "The Pentagon's Massive Accounting Fraud Exposed: How U.S. Military Spending Keeps Rising Even as the Pentagon Flunks Its Audit." He's called Dave Lindorf, longtime investigative reporter and author. He also writes for Salon, the London Review of Books, and Tarbell.org, sometimes for Fair.org as well. He joins us by phone from Philadelphia. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dave Lindorf.
Hi, Janine. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, actually, you know, this story, I first got on this story for an article for Fair back in 2016 when I saw a number in the alternative press about the $6.5 trillion expenditures in the Army budget of that year's Pentagon budget, which was only about $500 billion. And I thought, whoa, what's that? And then I started wondering why it wasn't in any of the mainstream media. So I did a little exploring as to what it was in the article. But the main point of the article was that it just wasn't being reported in the corporate media.
Well, and I'd like to hear some more history on that, because I'm reading about the Pentagon's first audit. And that doesn't, how can that be true?
Well, you know, in 1990, the Congress passed a bill called the CFO Act, which said that every federal agency had to have an auditable budget and had to submit to annual audits from outside auditors. And by, you know, somewhere around 2015, I think, 2014, every agency in the government did, in fact, have auditable budgets and was being audited externally annually, except for the Pentagon, which has steadfastly stonewalled against even making its budget auditable or even comprehensible. And finally, after years and years of this stonewalling, which was called out as stonewalling, by the way, by Chuck Grassley, senator from Iowa. He actually said in a hearing last year that he told the controller for the Pentagon that he was pretty much of a mind that they must at this point not want to be audited and be deliberately stalling, which I agree is true. So anyway, the Congress came up with last year $900 million to fund an audit, whether the Pentagon wanted it or not. And so for the past year, 1,200 outside auditors headed by Ernst & Young went over all the books. And on November 15th, they reported that they couldn't do it. The numbers were so screwy and impenetrable that they couldn't audit the Pentagon. Undersecretary Patrick Shanahan came out to the press and said, we had an audit, we failed it, and we thought we would fail it. And then he said, but we should get a lot of credit because we even attempted it. Well, the media reported that and his words saying they should get praised for what they did. And none of them bothered to point out that they'd been stonewalling for 26 years, so they don't get any credit at all.
Yeah, they almost made it sound as though, yeah, you know, they're right. It really is complicated, you know,
right.
As though that somehow excused it. Well, I mean, we can come back to media, although media certainly thread throughout this story. But in terms of the research that you did and that you were able to hook into, what did you uncover when you yourself went through that audit and talked to folks?
I started out with the numbers that were found last fall in a report by this professor from Michigan State University, Mark Skidmore, and two of his graduate students. They looked at all the reports of parts of the Pentagon budget done by the Pentagon's Office of Inspector General over a period from 1998 to 2015. That's an internal auditor monitor of the Pentagon. Every federal agency has an Office of Inspector General. And what they did was they would look at a part of the budget, like maybe one year it was the Marine budget, one year it was the Navy budget, one year it was the Air Force budget, one year it was the Army budget, and then they cycle around and they do other parts too of the Pentagon budget. But they never do the whole thing. And just those parts had these screwy numbers that were called plugs in Pentagon jargon, I found out. And they plugged these numbers in ostensibly to make things balance out or something. But the numbers are really screwy. They're like in the sometimes in the trillions of dollars. And there's never been a Pentagon budget more than, I think, the highest it ever was at the height of the Iraq War was $800 billion, so not $1 trillion. And they had ones that were as high as $6.5 trillion, $11 trillion. You know, really crazy numbers. And the total for over that period that they added up was $21 trillion, which is as much as the whole entire U.S. debt in the history of the country.
And that's money that's just, it goes in but doesn't come out? You kind of can't trace it? What do you mean when you say there's trillions of dollars and yet the budget is only billions of dollars?
Well, as Mark Skidmore points out, we don't know what the hell it is because there's no explanation for the numbers in any of the Inspector General's accounts. They just say these numbers aren't supported by ledger entries, and they say this has to be corrected or you can't do this again. And then, of course, they do it again the next year. But it makes the budgets unreadable and meaningless. So we don't know whether those are real entries for real money that's coming in. It's money going in and out. It's positive. It's on the positive side and the negative side, the assets and liabilities. So you don't know whether these are real, like, secret money coming in that's not appropriated by Congress, although I tend to doubt it. Some of it might be. Mark Skidmore says, we don't know. He says, maybe it is real money being printed by the Fed or something, or maybe some of it is real money that's being slipped to them from some other source. Or maybe what I think it is and what my sources in this story say is that the numbers are made up and they're meant to make the budgets unreadable by anybody and unauditable. Chuck Spinney, the whistleblower from the famous in the 80s for really exposing Pentagon corruption and fraud, said that he thinks the goal is to paralyze Congress and paralyze the media, not to be able to ask questions about the Pentagon budget because you can't understand it.
Well, let me just put a pin in the fact you just named Chuck Spinney. He's one of the sources that you rely on. You're not talking to folks who are kind of just making random guesses. Your sources in this story are folks who are insiders, who are close to this kind of accounting, and they're folks who are going on the record. And they're saying that a lot of money, its source and its destination, is just not available. And at a certain point, it starts to look less like, you know, accidentally sloppy bookkeeping and an actual, I mean, forgive me if I'm underscoring this too hard, but an actual intent to avoid accountability on the Pentagon's part.
Yeah, I think that, and that's my conclusion from the sources I talked to. Jack Armstrong, who was for 5 or 6 years the supervising director of audits at the Office of Inspector General, so really central to this, Armstrong said when they present their financial reports to Congress for the current year and for the prior year's documents, they should be telling Congress these reports are all garbage. And that's important. I mean, we're talking about $717 billion, which is 54% of the discretionary budget for the federal government. It's 54% of the taxes that every American pays to the federal government is being totally unaccounted for and is going to Congress in the form of garbage when they have to look and see what was done with the money that was allocated in the prior years. And the worst part about it is that that's being used to justify the next year's appropriation for the next fiscal year. So I just think if this were happening in the Department of Health and Human Services or in the EPA or the Department of Labor or the Department of Education, there would be calls for hearings, subpoenaing of secretaries under oath. There'd be Justice Department investigations, and there would also be investigative reporting by the mainstream media, but nothing about the Pentagon when this is happening.
Absolutely.
It's just mind-boggling to me.
It's mind-boggling to me as well, and I wanted to move you on to media because, you know, I read through the coverage, the New York Times in their editorial where they say, you know, quote, defense leaders have had less exacting standards, close quote. You know, I guess we're supposed to find that damning in its mildness or something, you know. But for the for the New York Times, the problem is, quote, the inability to accurately track how money is spent makes it impossible to know whether precious resources are going to the right places, undermining the Pentagon's ability to be successful in its far-flung missions around the globe, close quote. In other words, not about our precious resources not going to places like feeding hungry people, housing homeless people, healthcare to keep people alive. You know, it's not about the, even when they come to provide context, it's not a context about the government's ability to meet the needs of the people. It's as if the problem with the Pentagon spending too much unaccountably means that the Pentagon might run out of money that they can spend unaccountably, you know, that the context.
They won't be able to do the Imperial Project properly.
Exactly.
Without being able to know how they spend the money.
Exactly.
Well, I think they know how they spend the money. I think they just don't want us to know and the press to know, and they don't even want Congress to know. They're in violation of the Constitution. They aren't reporting to Congress as required. They aren't returning money that isn't spent as required by Article 1 in the Constitution. So, I mean, this is really serious stuff, and nobody in Congress is calling them on it. nobody's talking about the fakery in the books. And, you know, the Pentagon's excuse for years has been, well, we have these legacy systems, you see, and they don't talk to each other, and we can't tell what's going on because of that. But this has been 26 years that they have been saying it's our legacy systems. And believe me, back when I was using a K-Pro computer 26 years ago, they have the money to have long ago bought, you know, I don't know, 5 or 6 Watson computers and have the whole thing taken care of. The idea that they would say we still have legacy systems after 26 years of saying we have legacy systems is laughable.
It doesn't pass the laugh test. Well, I pulled you off it earlier, but I did want to ask what your response was to corporate media haymaking over Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in a tweet, who made reference to the $21 trillion that we're talking about that's unaccounted for, and, you know, made a mistake in suggesting that that was existing funds that might be turned to something else. But as a reaction to this information, I just wondered what you made of that kerfuffle.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. She picked up on the story and she tweeted out that there was $21 trillion in missing funds at the Pentagon, and that she noted that that would be 2/3 of what people are saying it would cost over 10 years to have Medicare for all. Her point is valid to a point in, you know, she's right about the amount. She was wrong about saying that it is missing money. It's not a pot of money, although Mark Skidmore says we don't know what it is, and it might be a lot of missing money, but we don't know that. And that's where she got caught being in error. I would have given her maybe one Pinocchio instead of 4 that the Washington Post fact check column gave her, because she did get the $21 trillion right, and it is a huge amount of unaccountable funding that the Pentagon is putting in its books. But I give her a lot of credit for getting the $21 trillion reported on in the Washington Post, which has studiously avoided any mention of the stunning report that Mark Skidmore did last fall. None of the mass media has reported on that. So this is the first mention. And, you know, as an aside, I want to thank Ocasio-Cortez for the fact-checking, which has said that our article is correct and that Skidmore's study is correct. So the question is, why haven't they reported on them? And also, why is it that after this Nation article has come out and is being seen as well-reported and correct, nobody from the mainstream media has contacted us and asked for an interview?
Which says a lot.
Unless you call NPR mainstream media, you know, that's semi-alternative. And then the rest are Pacifica stations and various independent stations, but no mainstream media.
Well, at FAIR, we oftentimes think about back in the late 80s when the New York Times' Keith Schneider was asked why the big papers were shying away from reporting the story of Iran-Contra. And he said, this story can shatter a republic. You know, I think it's so damaging and the implications are so extraordinary that for us to run the story, it had better be based on the most solid evidence we can amass, which essentially meant there is no amount of evidence that will be big enough. So in a way, the Defense Department defines too big to fail. And in some sense, for corporate media, the story's too big to tell.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned Iran-Contra, because one of the things that Chuck Spinney told me was that what we were learning is that one of the main reasons for these plugs in the budget is to allow the Pentagon to come into Congress and say, look, we spent all the money you gave us last year, we need more, when in fact they probably are not spending all the money they get each year. And then the money that doesn't get spent, which by law is supposed to be returned to the Treasury, gets what they have a term for it. It gets nippered away from the category it was in and moved to 5-year money in other parts of the budget, where it gets hidden away and becomes a slush fund that the Pentagon can use for black projects and other things that it wants to use it for without any observation. And when he mentioned that possibility, and other people had mentioned it, Chuck said that this actually happened before in the 80s and was exposed by him and other whistleblowers. And what they had done back then was overstated the amount of inflation when they were asking for their next year's budget. You might remember that was a high inflation period, but it never got over 10%, even for a brief period of time. They were slapping on 30% adjustments for inflation in their budget requests. And then when it didn't get spent, they would shunt it over to something called a merged surplus account, which was black money. And Spinney said that he and his whistleblowing colleagues think a bunch of it went to fund Iran-Contra. The total of it was something around the order of $60 to $100 billion in that merged surplus account. And when Weinberger was called into Congress, when they used to do real investigations, and asked where the money went, he said, "I don't know."
Well, finally, we know we need to shift something in media where they recognize that, first of all, Pentagon numbers, we don't just think in terms of trillions and billions. They have to be contextualized. They have to be put in terms of priorities. What else could mm-hmm. we be doing with that money, you know, that we often hear we can't afford to do? But then on a more fundamental level, I think something in the media and also in the public needs to shift where we recognize that we have a right to know this information.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things about this story that I got right at the end is that this body called the Financial Accounting Advisory Board, which sets the rules for federal accounting, approved a guideline that they had proposed in the summer and went through a 90-day comment period. And that guideline says now, effective October 4th and effective for the 2018 year that was being audited at the Pentagon, they said, if you have classified budgets, you can fake the numbers in those budgets and you can move some things you're funding out of the classified area into some other area where it won't be discovered. So basically, the new guidelines of the FASAB are basically legitimizing what the Pentagon's been doing for the last 26 years of making up numbers and hiding parts of their budget from any oversight. So unless something is done about that by Congress, unless they raise holy hell and say, no, you can't do that, that's going to be the norm.
All right, then. Well, there's lots more we can talk on, and I think we will, but we'll end it there for now. We've been speaking with reporter Dave Lindorf, among other things, a founding member of the online newspaper collective ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. You can find his expose on Pentagon accounting fraud exclusively at TheNation.com. Dave Lindorf, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShot.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You should worry about methane in the Arctic or the end of the Amazon rainforest, but room air conditioners or Bitcoin? Welcome to the Deadly Details on Radio EcoShock. World leaders get dire warnings about the climate, as they will this week at COP24 in Poland. But even those grim charts are lowball estimates of the real heat coming real fast. So much is left out, as we discover from this new research this week. Just two of many growing technologies can push up the global thermostat. Half a degree more from billions more room air conditioners, half a degree more from the digital currency Bitcoin, and pretty soon it all adds up to real hell. Let's find out how the unintended consequences of small technology could push us off the climate cliff with our guests Ian Campbell and Randy Rollins.
Radio EcoShock.
When I traveled through India in 1979, there were hardly any air conditioners. Now, in this warmer world, millions of people have moved from rural villages to cities. Little room air conditioners sprout like mushrooms from every wall in the cities. And according to a new report, that is just the start in China, India, and all over the world as humans try to cool themselves off on a hotter planet. The Rocky Mountain Institute warns room air conditioners alone could warm Earth by half a degree by the year 2100 on our current path. Unless we can find a better way, that AC is half a degree over the edge into climate disaster, in my opinion. So billionaire entrepreneur Richard Branson is offering $3 million to find better AC technology. To explore this climate threat you probably haven't heard about, we have Ian Campbell on the line. Ian is a senior fellow at the Rocky Mountain Institute and lead author of their report, Solving the Global Cooling Challenge. From Colorado, Ian Campbell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you, Alex. Happy to be speaking to you.
Ian, can we start with a snapshot? Why should we worry about a billion people installing room air conditioners, or RACs, as you call them?
It's really to do with the climate impact associated with air conditioners, and it's actually way beyond a billion. When you look at the number of air conditioning units we have in operation around the world today, it's around 1.2 billion, and with the trajectory that we're on, and you know, this is being driven by a combination of population growth, urbanization, rising income levels in developing countries, it's expected we're going to have 4.5 billion. So that's going to be like 3.3 billion more air conditioners in operation, and that has multiple impacts. It certainly has impacts on electricity systems. It has impacts on consumers' pockets, because most consumers, when they buy an air conditioner, have little idea as to how much it's going to cost to operate. And they also have impact on our climate.
You just returned from India, where the Minister of Science and Technology wrote the foreword to your report. When it comes to AC, what do you see on the streets of Mumbai or Delhi, and why is the Indian government so concerned?
You know, we've been speaking to people really around the world about this. We've been researching the space for the last year and a half. And the Indian government was actually the government that seemed to be most aware of what was happening, and which is actually incredible foresight, because when they look in the rearview mirror, they don't see the extent of penetration of cooling within their country that we would see here in the U.S. So in India, there's probably only about 30 million air conditioning units installed, but the expectation is, with a population of 1.1 billion people living in basically hot, humid climate zone, that's going to grow to, when we get to 2050, a billion. And that level, the electricity needed in India to power that many room air conditioners is larger than their existing grid capacity today for all end uses.
So there have been several reports and projections on the future of room air conditioners, and the latest comes from the International Energy Agency, or the IEA. It's called The Future of Cooling. Can you give us just a couple of hints of what they found?
It was very similar, and we did our own research and came to some of the same conclusions in relation to impact. So there's been, really over the last 18 months, there's been a growing awareness of the impact of cooling, and there's a really strong body of work out there. What we wanted to do was to take that a step further and go beyond talking about the issue and the challenge, but start looking at, well, how do we solve for this? I mean, one of the things we looked at was, you know, there's a lot of perspective out there that says, well, you know, we're going to be transitioning our grid infrastructure to be basically renewable energy generation. And, you know, if we do that fuel switch to renewables, that solves the challenge of the growing air conditioning demand. And it actually doesn't. And it would be a huge amount of infrastructure that would have to be put in place to power what is relatively inefficient equipment today, about 2,000 gigawatts of generating capacity. And globally last year, there was only 94 gigawatts of solar generation that came online. So the air conditioning demand actually dwarfs what the amount of renewable currently being deployed is.
Yeah, that's a strange thought that as we add more solar and wind, and we're all cheering for that, we're losing at least that by the number of new air conditioners that are quite inefficient being sold around the world.
Yeah, one of the staggering statistics, and we kind of stumbled across this, was that 2017 was a record year for solar deployment around the world, and there was 94 gigawatts installed. That was more than all new fossil fuel generation capacity that came online. But just in 2017, the incremental demand associated with new air conditioners coming into the market was actually over 100 gigawatts. So all of the solar capacity that was deployed, a record year in 2017, wasn't enough to just power that 1 year's worth of air conditioning sales.
So we break down the climate impact of air conditioning into two main factors, and I'm guessing that the first is the power burned, as we've been discussing, and that could come from coal power plants in places like China, India, or Arizona. So that's the main concern, is it, the power being burned?
Yes, it is, and it kind of gets a little complicated because you have things like grid emissions factors coming in, but, I mean, in broad brush terms, in most developed nations that have cleaner generating capacities or resource, it's about 3/5 of the climate impact is associated with the indirect emissions coming from power generation. In most developing countries where it's predominantly coal-fired plants, it's about 4/5 of the climate impact is from the indirect emissions associated with electric use. The remaining climate impact is the impact of refrigerant release through the life cycle of the unit, and the refrigerants that we are using today are particularly harmful from a global warming perspective.
Yes, I'd like to talk to you about those refrigerants more in just a minute, but first, I was surprised to read that the average room air conditioner sold in China is more efficient than what Americans buy. Now, why is that?
Yeah, so that kind of gets into different technologies in different markets, and I would assume that that comparison would be looking at the typical units that are sold in China, which is something called mini splits, which is really not a lot different to what we'd look at as a room air conditioner, but with the condenser and evaporator separated by a refrigerant line. You know, so it's a fairly contained unit, and when you compare that to a forced air unit, then the natural efficiencies associated with that additional step of actually fully conditioning the air is going to make it somewhat less efficient. But one of the things that also I think we see in these mini-split units is the utilization of inverter technology on the compressor, so they tend to perform very well at part load. And I think there's been less of a focus here in the U.S. on part load performance, although that is increasing with the focus on SEER, a seasonal energy efficiency ratio rating system.
So late in the 1980s, the world got together with the Montreal Protocol to try and remove CFCs from refrigeration because they were damaging the ozone layer, and the industry came up with an alternative cooling chemical, but that turns out to be a global warming problem. And then we have this agreement that pretty well nobody has heard about. Do you want to talk just for a minute about what the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol is and why that matters?
Yeah, so the Montreal Protocol, I think, was generally viewed as being incredibly successful in relation to the phase-out of ozone-depleting refrigerants and was really, I think, leveraged as a vehicle that had worked to seek agreement from effectively 197 nations to phase out HFC refrigerants, which, as you say, are those that have the high global warming potential. And it was one of those, I think, largely unintended consequences of we move from a refrigerant, a synthetic refrigerant that has ozone depleting potential, and then we jump on refrigerants that, as it turns out, have very high global warming potential. And the Kigali Amendment was actually agreed back end of 2016 and set a timeline for phase out of these HFC refrigerants, which are the ones that have very high global warming impact when released to the atmosphere, such that by 2040, we would be about an 80% reduction from where we are today. So it's a fairly extensive timeline for phase out, but part of that is to ensure that countries, industries have an sufficient time to be able to truly mobilize, because the next generation refrigerants aren't yet fully obvious to us.
Ian Campbell, you previously worked with a multi-billion dollar provider in the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning industry, so you know very well we're cooling everything from giant office towers to shopping malls to football stadiums. Why does this new report from the Rocky Mountain Institute focus almost exclusively on small room air conditioners?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one we asked ourselves a few times as we started to narrow our focus. But I guess two primary reasons. The first one is that if you want to drive impact, you have to focus, because when you dilute your focus across multiple kind of end-use requirements, you start to see that there's going to be differing solution sets that are necessary. So if you want to solve something, you have to pick the one that you want to solve. The reason that we picked the residential is it's the largest and it's the most accessible. So what I mean by that is, you know, 70% of the air conditioning systems out there today are residential, so small, basically apartment and small homes. And they're the most accessible. It's kind of the first step on to a life of air-conditioned comfort, let's say, where in many developing markets, you can take that first step and get an air conditioner to keep your room comfortable of a night when it may be 120 degrees ambient temperature outside, so that you and your family can sleep overnight. And it becomes a very highly desirable purchase, similar to a TV or a refrigerator in a family's kind of criteria of where does their available disposable income go. So for those reasons, plus also it's the segment that is perhaps the hardest to solve, because the procurement decisions being made by consumers, you know, it's very difficult to understand EER and SEER ratings and COP and all these kind of thermodynamically based rating systems. And so the procurement decision is largely made on the price of the unit and does it look nice? And is it a recognized brand? Those are probably the three main criteria. So it's the hardest to solve. So we wanted to pick the biggest, the hardest, and the most accessible to impact first.
And as you know, there's other extreme solutions out there, like geoengineering blocking out sunlight, or building more homes and businesses underground, or we could put a big dome over the city, the sci-fi writers tell us. Are any of those really worth considering? And if so, might they derail that coming wave of room air conditioners?
This is one where our belief is that the impact is so significant when we just look at residential air conditioning and we look at the risk of just that one end use being half a degree of global warming by the base year of 2100. There's so much that we need to do, it becomes an and not an or. So, you know, one of the things we identified in our report was, what if we do everything that we already know how to do? So, you know, increasing minimum energy performance standards, improved building envelopes, more stringent building codes, modifying occupier behavior, or influencing occupier behavior to, you know, have wider temperature bands within buildings. And so many, many things, and it doesn't come close to abating that half a degree impact that will happen on a business as usual pathway, which was why we said, well, we believe we need to have a dramatically more efficient technology for cooling. And we also believe that, you know, based upon landscaping of what's out there, that it's also possible. So that was the path that we took, but this is an and. And, you know, one of the things that we would also believe is great is in residential new development, district systems are actually, you know, a super efficient way to be able to provide cooling to many buildings, as opposed to having discrete systems or pieces of equipment on every building, especially in dense urban environments. So there's lots of solutions. We shouldn't preclude any. Our focus, though, is laser focused on the efficiency of standalone residential cooling systems, because that doesn't require behavior change. When you have it embedded within the technology, you know that efficiency will deliver.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Ian Campbell, Senior Fellow at the Rocky Mountain Institute. We are talking about how to cool you off in a hotter world without making global warming worse. At least that's the hope. Now, I love all the facts and figures in this report, Ian, solving the global cooling challenge. It is in plain English with lots of good graphs. Anybody could read it at rmi.org, and I hope they will. But the ending's a little frustrating. You don't provide a great solution. You don't tell us what the technology is. Why not?
So we actually, in conjunction with launching the report, with the support of Mission Innovation, which is an initiative of the Clean Energy Ministerial and the Government of India, and a number of other supporters, including, as you mentioned, Sir Richard Branson, we actually launched a global cooling prize. And you know, one of the things which we did in conjunction with the report was we did a lot of landscaping to understand what we felt was possible. But when you're looking for a next generation technology, someone's described that as like looking for a needle in a haystack. But when you run a prize, the needle comes to find you. So we launched the prize in earlier this month in Delhi in India. The reason we did it in Delhi in India is it's going to be the world's largest market for air conditioning over the next 30 years. And to get industry's attention, you need to have a large market. And so we picked the largest one. And the approach that we took was not to be prescriptive about technologies, but just to define an outcome. So a line in the sand of performance for a next generation cooling technology, and then effectively let the market have at it and see what comes up that is closest to the full set of criteria that we've stated. And assuming that we have multiple and diverse technologies getting through that first stage, to then effectively pick a or even a number of winners that we can work with going forward. So we didn't want to be prescriptive on technologies, and we have to be very careful now we launched on the prize to not effectively imply any technology bias, because we want to see as many diverse technologies come through as possible.
Suppose I come up with a new type of air conditioner and it doesn't use global warming gases and it requires much less energy. I win this global cooling challenge and industry starts pumping out new design AC units. But then we have the Jevons paradox, where greater efficiency leads to greater use. What stops another billion homes installing the new AC and therefore multiplying the total power use beyond your worst projections?
Yeah. So actually, we did model for that. You know, one of the things we did was we modeled for the extent of the climate impact, but also grid impact associated with the business as usual. We then said, okay, our criteria is 5 times lower climate impact, which is largely going to come from improved efficiency. In fact, it has to be at least 4 times on efficiency to be able to get 5 times less climate impact, with the remaining piece being associated with the refrigerant. And we modeled the impact of that, but said that it's likely that there will be a rebound effect where consumers are perhaps wary of how much it costs to operate the unit today. If it costs a quarter of the cost to operate it in the future because there's a super efficient technology, will they run it for more hours? And unfortunately, I think the answer to that question is yes. And we did model the impact associated with that. But a unit using 4 times less energy, at least 4 times less energy, that rebound effect, although it has an impact, is pretty modest in relation to what you've achieved because of the leapfrog in technology.
I have another small quibble with the report, and I'm sure you're aware of this. You can't include everything, but saying room AC could create an additional 0.5 degree of warming assumes a more or less linear relationship between gigatons of carbon emitted and the warming that results. But I talk with scientists who say we don't know Earth's climate sensitivity. You know, an additional 0.5 degree of warming from AC or Bitcoin or whatever may trigger natural responses like deforestation or deglaciation of Greenland. So that little 0.5 degree may produce another big degree of warming. So is it a worry to rely on straight calculation of gigatons to temperature?
Yes, it is, but I'm not sure we're smart enough to do anything other than apply a linear relationship to that, which is obviously what most folks have done in this space. And it is only indicative, but you know, one of the challenges is when we look at 2100 and we look at a cumulative gigaton of CO2 equivalent, you know, we're looking at about just over 700 gigatons by 2100. And if we communicate that it's 700 gigatons, I'm not sure that means much to many of the people that will just see the headlines and, you know, kind of pick up the summaries of some of the analysis and work that we've done. So we felt compelled to put that into terminology that is more readily understood. But obviously, we do understand that it's far from a perfect correlation. And obviously, we've assumed that perfect linear correlation, which is not reasonable, but we believe it is indicative.
Ian, from your travels and your experience in the AC industry, do you have any doubt that as the world heats up, humans will adopt air conditioning to survive?
I have no doubt. If you think of where the air conditioners, so I kind of mentioned that we've got 1.2 billion air conditioners installed around the world. Most of those are in developed nations, and most developed nations sit in more temperate climates. And so we're talking of places like Europe, like North America, like Japan. But what we're going to see is by 2030, half of the world's population, which is going to be approaching 4 billion people, are going to be living within the subtropics. And these are developing nations, and there's very low levels of penetration in air conditioning. And the two factors that are going to really drive, well, I think there's three factors that really drive this. One is urbanization. The other is rising income levels. And then the third is rising temperatures. My knowledge of the industry and the work and research that we've done, we are on an inevitable pathway of dramatic growth in cooling. And it goes beyond, I think, comfort. It's also about things like health and productivity. And, you know, as we know, at its most extreme, it can also be about survival, especially in very dense urban environments where you have those heat island. You know, this is a problem that's still largely in front of us. So, you know, the positive element coming out of this analysis is it's not so much about fixing what we've already done. It's about fixing what we're about to do with the ramp up of comfort cooling around the world and the technology that is serving that.
Well, this scares me, and I'll tell you why. I worry that instead of moving away from fuels that ruin the atmosphere, we will just keep adapting to the damages. If we all move inside to so-called climate-controlled environments, we risk heading towards that dystopia that director Terry Gilliam portrayed in his 1985 movie Brazil. That made quite an impact on me, that movie. So I wonder if better technology is not really the answer to climate change, but a massive social change will be needed too.
Yeah, so I think that's a great point, Alex. And, you know, as I kind of mentioned earlier, I think this is an and. You know, there's a big thing that we also need to do on behavior. You have to be careful how you say that, but effectively behavior modification, which is, you know, how do we influence people to manage their thermal comfort differently? And, you know, how do we get away from it just has to be, you know, as we talk about here, 72-degree conditioned air, and we can't tolerate anything above or below that. And how does that and why does that make sense? Certainly in many of the areas within the tropics, we're seeing people, governments effectively saying, you know, the thermal comfort, the threshold, we believe should be at 27 degrees centigrade, which is about 80 degrees Fahrenheit. And you shouldn't be cooling spaces below that. And you should dress appropriately. And air movement has an impact. And, you know, we should use fans and, you know, some of these other techniques to achieve thermal comfort and get away from, well, we're just going to have 72 degree conditioned air, and that's the only thing we need to do. So this is an and. I wouldn't say that having the right technology is on its own is going to solve it, and we can happily go on with 72 degree conditioned air. I do believe that we have to do many things to ensure that our energy consumption and the mitigation of rebound effects is actually manageable.
You've just launched this challenge with RMI and Branson and your other partners. Have you seen any feelers of interest yet?
Oh, yeah. We had many of the world's largest manufacturers were at the launch event. We've already had sort of the process is that we initially ask people to register their intent to apply so we can kind of understand the cross-section of who we're going to see applications from. And then later on in the cycle, they'll deliver their technical specifications for review by the technical review committee of the prize. And, you know, we've seen registration by some of the world's largest air conditioning manufacturers, including the world's largest, that has already happened within a week of launch, and also many small innovative players that have been sitting in the shadows of the giant and very much consolidated air conditioning industry. And, you know, one of the things which I should explain is the air conditioning industry has been driven by economies of scale because especially in the residential space, because when the market is buying on lowest price, you get to win if you have lowest cost, and you get to have lowest cost if you have the greatest scale. So, you know, 70% of the world's residential air conditioners are manufactured in China, and half of that is with two companies. And so it's really tough for new technologies to get a foothold or access to the market. And that's one of the things that we're looking to do with the prize is to shine a spotlight on the market so we can see what's in the shadows. And, you know, a number of these small players with some really intriguing technologies have already started stepping out and indicating their intent to apply.
Yes, we have to remember that Apple computers came out of Steve Jobs' garage and not really out of IBM. So there may be some really inventive people out there who could use this challenge to leverage their way up and get us some better air conditioners that don't wreck the climate. We've been speaking with Ian Campbell, a senior fellow at the Rocky Mountain Institute, headquartered in Boulder, Colorado. You can find out a lot more at rmi.org. I will put links to their new report, Solving the Global Cooling Challenge, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ian, thank you so much for informing us about this.
Thanks for the opportunity, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Bitcoin and blockchain, they're breaking tech used by a growing public, even though few of us understand how cryptocurrency even works. Now we find out this new money could be a threat to our future climate if it unfolds as it might. Let me just read from this University of Hawaii press release, quote, "A new study published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature Climate Change finds that if Bitcoin is implemented at similar rates at which other technologies have been incorporated, it alone could produce enough emissions to raise global temperature by 2 degrees C as soon as 2033, end quote. 2033. Now, if that's true, that's shocking stuff. And to find out more, we've reached a co-author of the new study, master's student Randy Collins from Honolulu. Randy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, how is it going, Alex?
It's going well here, but it got me wondering, you're part of the Department of Biology. Why are you also part of a new study on Bitcoin?
So I am. I am in the biology department working on my master's and transitioning to a PhD. However, I'm also very interested in climate change and the effects on species diversity and conservation of organisms on the planet. And there was an opportunity to join a group of colleagues, interdisciplinary, so people from different departments that bring different expertise, and work on large-scale analysis of a broad, pressing issue. So I joined the group, and there in the group we discussed ideas and what issues we're presenting currently and where, what kind of data we have to analyze. So that's how I got involved with this project regarding Bitcoin.
I've never used it. Have you ever used Bitcoin personally? And if so, how easy is that transaction, say, compared to using a credit card to pay for something?
I have not made a purchase with Bitcoin. I personally have not made a transaction with Bitcoin. However, looking into the platform and being familiar, it's quite easy to complete a transaction, especially now. There are many applications that you can use to process your transactions, and many websites that you can go to access the Bitcoin platform. So it's much like using a debit or credit card online.
Well, I heard an interview on National Public Radio, and Douglas McCauley was suggesting that some Greens really like the blockchain tech behind Bitcoin. They think it could help track many complex things like carbon emissions or reforestation. It was sort of a rah-rah thing, but they haven't heard your science. Now, should people accept cryptocurrency and blockchain as the next big thing, as a way to help the planet? What are your concerns about that?
That we looked into. Blockchain technology, when it was developed, it took about over 10 years for it to be implemented into a currency, right? Bitcoin took existing blockchain technology and developed it into this decentralized cashless payment system, which has a lot of pros associated with it, just kind of taking out the middleman, reducing third-party fees and whatnot. Blockchain technology in and of itself is a great innovation, and I think it can propel us forward. However, in the case of Bitcoin, when using this blockchain technology, there's an associated proof of work that must occur. It verifies the transactions that occur on the Bitcoin platform. And it is that proof of work process that is so incredibly energy consumptive. So that's where the problem lies with the verification process. There are other alternatives to proof of work, however, and some cryptocurrencies use these alternatives, such as proof of stake or a hybrid of proof of work and proof of stake. So cutting out the proof of work or modifying the structure of the proof of work can drastically reduce the resulting CO2 emissions.
All right, so we better stop and go back a little bit. Now, I make a transaction, and that somehow is gathered up into blocks. And where does the proof of work come in, and why do we need it? Why is it being used?
So the Bitcoin platform is decentralized, right? Meaning there is not a bank that oversees the process or a centralized entity that oversees the transactions. So it's all of the members of Bitcoin community can access, we'll call it a ledger, right? A record of all transactions through the history of Bitcoin. So every member of Bitcoin can access this ledger and verify it. So as you mentioned, a transaction goes into a block. So if I want to send you $5, I announce that to the platform. I put that out there. All Bitcoin members can see this transaction, and we need someone called a miner. So Bitcoin miners take the transaction, put it in a block. Then they need to verify that block before the transaction can be complete. So before I can send you that $5, I announce it. It needs to be verified so that I don't send you $5 while I send three other people $5, and then I don't have any money left after one person gets the five, right? So to verify that process, after a miner puts transactions into a block, and a block has a limit on how much data can go into each block, so X amount of transactions allowed, that verification process occurs through a complicated algorithm that needs to be solved. We call this a cryptographic hash function. And so a miner uses a computer, a mining rig, to solve this complicated algorithm. And that takes about 10 minutes on average to solve each block, and that is the energy consumptive process, that complicated algorithm being solved for.
Well, yes, and your paper goes into the economics of this, pointing out that in May 2018, doing the proof of work for a single block would pay out about $116,000 U.S., for that 10 minutes of computing time. And I thought, wow, that sounds pretty profitable. And according to a site called digiconomist.net that tracks such things, 23% of that payout is profit. So that's a pretty high profit margin. It makes me wonder why every server farm in the world isn't just out there processing Bitcoin data and making big money.
Right. I mean, it has become very profitable with the value of Bitcoin increasing. More people join the platform to mine Bitcoin, right? So in the early days of Bitcoin, 2009 on, most miners were just folks at home using personal computers, CPUs. However, the way Bitcoin works for the proof of work, let me back that up a little bit. The genesis idea of Bitcoin was to have a block solved about every 10 minutes, right? So if you add more people to the platform and the difficulty of solving the block stays the same, the block will be solved faster with more people. So the Bitcoin network is set up where the more folks that join the Bitcoin platform and mine to solve the blocks, the more difficult the algorithm becomes to keep that 10-minute interval on average between blocks solved. The more difficult the algorithm is, the harder the mining rigs need to work and the more electricity it takes to solve these blocks. And because of that, it is incredibly expensive to mine for Bitcoin now. So we've moved from using CPUs people started adopting GPUs to mine Bitcoin in about 2011. Something called Field Programmable Gate Arrays, FPGAs, came on the market. Folks started using these to mine for Bitcoin. And now, in late 2011, something called an ASIC, an application-specific integrated circuit, is now the standard, the gold standard for mining Bitcoin. So what the ASIC is, it's a piece of hardware that is built and designed specifically to mine Bitcoin, the cryptographic hash function associated with Bitcoin. These ASICs are incredibly powerful, and they solve for 14 terahashes a second. That's astronomical, literally. And they're incredibly energy consumptive to supply the power to do these processes. And so that factors in a high electricity bill. So the cost it takes to mine for Bitcoin has now kind of pushed out the little guys, right? Anyone at home wanting to mine on their computer, they don't really stand a chance with all of these ASICs mining Bitcoin now.
And it's mind-blowing, but then we get to the bottom line. What is the estimate of greenhouse gas emissions for the Bitcoin industry for 2017?
Yeah, so all of the data for Bitcoin is accessible. You can access that. You can see every block solved and added to the blockchain since the history of Bitcoin in 2009. There are currently over 500,000 blocks on this blockchain. So we accessed the 2017 data, and with every block, you can see how many transactions were in that block and who won the block, right? So what miner won the block, whether it's a mining pool, so a group of people that work together, or an individual. So we use that data, and we found the country that the mining pool or individual is associated with, and looked at their main source of electricity, so their energy fuel mix, and use that to calculate the CO2 emissions per block. All in all, we calculated that in 2017, Bitcoin usage emitted 69 megaton of carbon dioxide equivalent. So that's quite a lot of carbon emissions. Seen it referred to as equivalent to about 17 power plants. So that's from 1 year with Bitcoin.
17 power plants going full out 24/7 just to process Bitcoin, and we're still in the infancy of this cryptocurrency, and it could blow up much bigger than that. And that's really the point of your paper, is what happens when it does blow up much bigger than that. So what kind of projections did you work with, and how did you come to the frightening 2-degree mark coming so soon?
Bitcoin, we looked at Bitcoin as it's been adopted, right, as a new technology emerges. If it becomes broadly adopted, we mirrored that to other broadly adopted technologies, right? And so we took about 40 other broadly adopted technologies and analyzed their trajectory, so their rate of adoption over time. And we used things like common household appliances, washing machines, water heaters, e-book readers, electric power, color TVs, etc. So,
now, can I just stop you for a second? Were those adoption rates just for the United States or globally, or how did you work that out?
We took the 40 different technologies, and the data came from the United States reference, and then the credit card data also from the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. That's where our data was drawn from for these other technologies.
That's a fascinating subset of this paper right on its own. I mean, just looking at how fast technologies move out into society and what percentage of the population use them. And as you say, it's color TVs, it's power steering, it's smartphones, and it's air conditioning, all sorts of interesting things. But I have to wonder, adoption rates by larger populations will be the key, like India, China, Brazil, and they may be faster than it happened in the United States because it's all known already, or it may be slower because people can't afford it. How could you predict global rates for technologies used in this study and then project from that Bitcoin usage?
There have been a few analyses of the electricity consumption of Bitcoin, and we referenced a couple of them in our paper. You had actually mentioned the DigiConomist website, and DigEconomist does do estimates for Bitcoin energy consumption. Also, a paper by Fontanus that came out in 2018, I believe, looked at the energy consumption. So, but they use different methods for analyzing this. So we thought about all of the approaches that we could take to look at the energy consumption and then our prediction power going forward. And we are unable to predict the fate of Bitcoin, but we wanted to look at if it did follow the rate of other broadly used technologies, whether they be quickly adopted or adopted on a much more slow pace, what the outcome could be. And so looking at Bitcoin on these trajectories, it's still an astounding number, even if Bitcoin follows the most slowly adopted technologies that we analyzed. It still produces, you know, the emissions necessary to reach that 2-degree threshold in about 22 years, if it follows the slowest broadly adopted technologies. We decided this would be a good way to look at the Bitcoin future.
Well, this is so weird because we are looking in official papers at the IPCC of getting to 2-degree warming or trying to stay under that by 2100. But now we're talking, and when we worry about those things, we usually worry about things like deforestation, the loss of Arctic sea ice, and other major factors. But just the introduction of a new technology, if it goes viral and if it keeps going and succeeds at the rates of other technologies, that could do us over the 2-degree danger zone by in 22 years. I mean, that's amazing that we could have that happen in a human population.
Maybe the reality of climate change and its subsequent effects, like changing climates, increased natural disasters, food, crop shortages, etc., drought, might just seem a little unrealistic to many people, right? It's hard to imagine that happening. And it isn't new. We've been aware of this problem for decades. And now we're kind of at this critical point. We need to take action. And somebody asked me recently, why should we worry about Bitcoin? We have these other issues, right? Deforestation, agriculture, fossil fuels. And it's not a choice to pick one or the other, right? We need to focus on all of these issues. Now, currently, Bitcoin is not at the level of those big emission polluters that I just mentioned. But if it does follow these rates of adoption, it could happen. And as you mentioned, all other emerging technologies potentially could carry the same fate. So this study is really important to me as it can highlight the importance of assessing emerging technologies and upcoming sectors of development and keeping the carbon footprint in mind, right? Being aware and engineering into your technology mitigation strategies, because we are at this critical point, definitely.
I think anytime humans make a change, we have to be aware of success, of what happens if something really takes off. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Randy Rollins from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And we're talking about how Bitcoin could break the climate bank, so to speak. And Randy is co-author of a new paper in Nature Climate Change titled Bitcoin Emissions Alone Could Push Global Warming Above 2 Degrees C. Your paper does touch on several solutions. And I suppose the first way to avoid 2 degrees with Bitcoin is that this digital currency fails. Perhaps spectacularly. Is that still a possibility?
Bitcoin is a volatile market, right? We see it jump up and skyrocket in value for Bitcoin and then decrease. But there is a general trend in an increase. And I can't predict the fate of Bitcoin. I think that the idea, the technology, the decentralized cash payment system is a way of the future. And it just needs to be, the emissions need to be mitigated, right? And I mentioned when we first started speaking, Alex, that Bitcoin uses a proof of work to verify transactions so that we can make payments to each other on the Bitcoin network. If that proof of work is changed into a proof of stake, verification process, that could drastically reduce the CO2 emissions. So that's one way to mitigate this issue. Also with Bitcoin, something like I mentioned in a block, there's a cap to the number of transactions that can go into the block. Actually, technically, it's the amount of data that can be inserted into a block. If we raise that cap, so if more transactions can fit into a block, that would drastically reduce the emissions associated with Bitcoin as well. So there are alternatives to this issue. Also, using green, sustainable energy sources would completely mitigate these problems, as well as other sectors and industry. So I think using green renewable resources is key for the future of Bitcoin or any other cashless payment.
Yeah, so why couldn't we just move the data mining to a place that uses renewable energy? But I guess you'd have to have governments mandating that. And I also wonder about gaining efficiency in the actual computers used to do this. I mean, the manufacturer of Bitmain's Antminer S9 computer claimed their new model has 3 times the power and twice the efficiency of their previous S7 model. So maybe also hardware improvements. But I guess those hardware improvements are never going to keep up if Bitcoin, you know, like Walmart starts adopting it and Amazon, both those don't accept it right now. But if they did, then it could just balloon way out there.
Right. If a large corporations adopt Bitcoin payment, then the system would become flooded and we would need more people to join the network to mine the blocks to verify the transactions, right? So we would be inputting a much greater need for electricity, increasing those demands. And yes, improving the hardware for mining Bitcoin could reduce these electricity draws, right? But we've seen improvement over time, but it's not enough. Like in 2017, right, 69 megatons of carbon just from mining Bitcoin. And we're not calculating the electricity required to keep the equipment cool. That's a whole nother part of this that we didn't factor in. So our numbers are actually conservative in that regard.
And, you know, we talked about the possibility of Bitcoin crashing, but another way that cryptocurrency could really take off is if, in fact, it's the regular currencies, the dollar, the yen, or any other currency could crash so badly that the population flees to Bitcoin and maybe economic difficulties push that warming footprint way out as well.
That's an interesting thought, you know, by necessity, joining the Bitcoin network with the crash of other currencies, right? So Bitcoin is the most well-known cryptocurrency, the large cryptocurrency. And as I mentioned, there are actually hundreds of different cryptocurrencies available of varying platform sizes. And I believe Ethereum, which is another popular cryptocurrency, transitioned to this other verification process, proof of stake. So if cryptocurrencies can do that, if Bitcoin can make that transition or other proofs are developed, methods for verification, then that can help circumvent the issue. Like if the scenario you just proposed, if people flock to these decentralized payment systems due to a fiat currency crash, then that could help prepare us for that.
And another weird part of this whole story is that it seems Bitcoin in particular has also succeeded because it can evade government monitoring or control, and thus it's often been used to move money made by crime or corruption. And if crime or corruption increases, that too could push more Bitcoins and thus add to global warming. Isn't that a strange twist?
Yeah, I guess my thoughts on that are the underground dealings, purchases on Silk Road and et cetera on the deep web are unintended consequences of having a decentralized cash payment system. However, I think that these illegal or shady dealings occur in our society regardless of what monetary system we're using. Kind of if there's a will, there's a way, and it's going to happen. And, you know, I don't know what the direct effect on CO2 emissions or climate change would be from increasing crime, but certainly when folks are wrapped up in, you know, a criminal world or under punishment for criminal activities, then it's more difficult to contribute to decarbonization or climate change mitigation practices. So, yeah, that's another aspect to think about.
One thing I really like about this paper is hardly anybody asks when a new technology appears, hey, what happens if this really succeeds? And you've done that, and I like the analysis of other technologies and how fast they expanded. Was there a particular person at the University of Hawaii who really asked this question and said, hey, we've got to look at Bitcoin and see what's going on there?
Yeah, Alex, I'm really glad you asked this. So there was a small group of us that came together to do this large-scale analysis on a broad issue that I had mentioned when we first started speaking. And one of my colleagues on this project, her name is Katie Talladay. She is a PhD student in the geography department here at UH Manoa. And she actually proposed the idea of looking at Bitcoin. We came together for a meeting and she brought it to the table one day. She, you know, Bitcoin had been kind of in the news. People have been, a lot of to-do had been going on about Bitcoin, and she put two and two together and brought it to the table. I started looking into the impacts of Bitcoin. I've been interested and fascinated by this system for probably since about 2012 or 2013. However, I was completely unaware of the electricity demand and resulting emissions from this platform. So when I started digging into it and all of us in the group looked at this, I think we were all very surprised. So Katie Talladay brought the idea to the table, and we thank her for that.
As we wrap this up, Randy, are you going back to biology studies, or have you always been continuing them anyway, or has the digital world captured your attention?
So, you know, yes and yes. So I'm still working in the realm of biology and conservation. So climate change goes hand in hand in what I'm looking at, species diversity. However, technology is incredibly interesting. I use a lot of technology for modeling, but as for continuing my studies in the Bitcoin world, we'll see what comes of that. I'm not sure if it's in the future or not yet.
From Honolulu, we've been talking with Randy Rollins from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. She is co-author of a paper led by Radio EcoShock guest Camilo Mora, titled Bitcoin Emissions Alone Could Push Global Warming Above 2 Degrees C. And that was published on October 29, 2018 in the journal Nature Climate Change, a prestigious journal. Randy, thank you so much for helping us through the unknown side of secret money.
Thank you so much. It's been a joy being able to talk with you about this.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. In addition to our radio audience around the world, my California Fire special blog resulted in over 8,000 audio downloads. Our guest, Mariah Gallardin, host of TUC Radio, reports the fires are mostly out after an atmospheric river almost drowned California. If those rains had just come 2 weeks earlier, hundreds of lives might have been saved in the little town of Paradise. Sometimes climate change can lengthen a season by 2 weeks or delay rains, and that is how much 2 weeks can matter. Right now, Mariah doesn't want to try the mud-soaked roads at the ranch. Without trees, the burned hills are slipping down, carbon is running into every creek, and local rivers are running black. The spotlight of world media will move on, but for a lot of folks in Northern California, there is nowhere to move to except away. Now it is Australia's turn in the climate barrel. The east coast of that country experienced record heat and then fires too large and too fast for anyone to control. As the world warms and winds shift, the earth becomes more flammable.
Gone.
expanding Australian coal sales will kill millions of people and create millions of climate refugees. On Friday, November 30th, thousands of Australian students walked out of class to protest government inaction on climate. Give them power and let it spread. What are you going to do?
We are the caretakers, guardians of the earth, caretakers. Time to do a little more caring and a little less.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
This pushback and the suppression that we're facing, is it's so clear that they're genuinely afraid that we can do something, that we can actually have some sort of momentum and shift the tide in the United States, at least, in support of Palestine.
My advocacy for justice in for Palestine as part and parcel of the indivisibility of justice has been vindicated.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. First, we take a look at the recent National Students for Justice in Palestine conference, which was held at the University of California at Los Angeles, or UCLA. In the weeks leading up to the conference, student supporters of Palestinian rights had been facing multifaceted attacks and smear campaigns by university administrators, local city leadership, and anti-Palestinian groups. Los Angeles City Council members unanimously passed a resolution condemning the National Students for Justice in Palestine conference. The resolution openly accused members of Students for Justice in Palestine, or SJP, of holding anti-Semitic beliefs and called on the UCLA administration to shut down the event. Taking a page from an Israel advocacy playbook, Paul Koretz, the council member who brought the resolution forward, himself claimed that SJP members have advocated for violence against Jewish people and, in no casual terms, directly linked them to the bigotry that led to the massacre at the synagogue in Pittsburgh in October. A week before, in a bizarre and desperate attempt to derail the conference, the UCLA administration sent students a cease and desist letter claiming that their illustration of a bear on conference promotional materials violated the university's trademark. The Bruin Bear is the university mascot. UCLA backed down on its cease and desist demands after receiving a letter from Palestine Legal and the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of SJP. SJP stood firm in its rights to advertise its conference with a bear holding a Palestinian flag, but agreed to remove the word UCLA from its poster because the conference location was obvious. In an op-ed in the LA Times just before the conference began, UCLA's Chancellor Jean Block seemed to agree with the LA City Council's smears against SJP, but wrote that he would allow the conference to go on because he believes in free speech. Despite the blatant attempts to repress it, National Students for Justice in Palestine and the Palestinian youth movement say that more than 550 students, speakers, artists, and organizers, quote, attended the conference to learn about radical hope, resistance in the face of adversity, making it the largest student conference focused on the Palestinian struggle to date. The groups added that, quote, no matter how severe the opposition was, scores of attendees came and learned about the Palestinian plight, and that is something that no resolution, no administrative critique, and no disruption will ever be able to take away. Joining us to talk about the conference and the organizing by students to challenge the ongoing repression by Israel lobby groups, lawmakers, and university administrations is Aisha Khan of National Students for Justice in Palestine. Aisha, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
There's so much to cover about the National SJP Conference. It happened more than a week ago. This year's theme was Radical Hope, Resistance in the Face of Adversity. In the joint statement that came out this week, National SJP and the Palestinian youth movement say that resistance to that adversity is certainly about the wider Palestinian struggle for freedom, but it also applies to what students faced when trying just to put this conference on. Can you talk about the situation right now for students organizing for Palestinian rights on campuses in the U.S. and what you've been facing in terms of Zionist groups, university administrators, and even the local city council members who are all trying to shut this movement and this conference down?
Yeah, I think we've kind of faced backlash for a long time, but this time around with NSGP coming to Los Angeles, we had a particularly intense series of backlash and events that basically made it clear to us that not just university administrators, but elected official representatives that are supposed to represent their constituents are spreading very dangerous Islamophobic, anti-Arab tropes about what SJP is. We never got approached once by anybody that wrote about us, whether it was LA City Council member Paul Koretz, Brad Sherman, other elected representatives, or Gene Block himself, who wrote an op-ed for the LA Times that was also pretty inflammatory, where he made assumptions about what SJP does and basically said that he would just like to hold a conference to just tolerate and preserve the marketplace of ideas, even though we're very clear in that we challenge all forms of bigotry, including anti-Semitism, and promote justice and equality for everybody without any exceptions. It was just, we've been attacked frequently, but we were very misrepresented by the UCLA administration, even in their cease and desist letter, when they tried to imply that us using a kite on top of the bear with the dove somehow could imply an endorsement of violence, which I think is kind of the reason we wrote our statement with PYM, because it was so important for us to actually talk about all of these things that happened surrounding the conference. And we were so focused on trying to put the conference on that we were just in crisis mode the entire time. Like, you know, we would shut down one fire where we would respond to the cease and desist letter, and then that ended up working out thanks to Pal Legal and ACLU. And then the next thing we know, we have this LA City Council resolution and then Gene Block. And then at the time, we were just in survival mode, and we just tried to do whatever we could to keep the conference going and to make sure students on campus feel safe and secure, mostly because we did have a very aggressive counter-protest at the conference that was organized by a lot of off-campus groups that weren't students, actually, that have a documented history of assaulting students on campus. So we were more concerned about security and safety more than anything else. But I think now that the dust has settled from the conference, we kind of have time to process how truly horrific all of the coverage around the conference was, where NSJP was never approached about what we do and who we are. And this is by, you know, administrators and actual representatives who are supposed to have our best interests in mind and protect students, whether it's just UCLA students. And that didn't happen. And to look at how problematic it is for elected representatives to casually say that, oh, they might be plotting terrorism. Just sentences like that that were so casually published in the LA Times and the Daily Bruin by congressmen. And I think it's really important to actually hit at how problematic and how dangerous that could be for the safety of students who are just social justice organizers trying to do something good.
Aisha, let's talk a little bit more in detail about the LA City Council resolution. Can you talk about what it said, the thrust of it, and how students are responding and organizing against it?
Yeah, so, I mean, the gist of the resolution was that SJP is inherently, like you said, tied to anti-Semitism across the United States. And given that there's a steep rise of a very real threat of anti-Semitism and violence against the Jewish community, that somehow that is all propagated by SJP, and that is the focus of our work. And therefore, the conference should be banned, and UCLA should not allow this to happen because we are imposing violence and physical threat to the Jewish community at UCLA and broader Los Angeles. And I think that was just ridiculous. I mean, and it was a resolution that was passed unanimously, brought to the table by Paul Koretz, but not once were we approached ever about what is this conference about, even to ask us what we're going to do and what we're doing, who we are, and all that information is publicly available. And it's very obvious the work we've done over the past few years, you know, hand in hand with our Jewish organizations that we're allied with, like Jewish Worship Peace, to do the work that we need to do to mobilize actively against all forms of bigotry. And I think that was just completely dismissed. But I think now we kind of took that and just basically try to focus all of our energy on making sure that we are, in fact, actively in solidarity, in tangible solidarity with the Jewish community, because regardless of what people say about our organization, it was important to us that we're actually mobilizing for the community. So I think a beautiful part of this conference was that we had a Jewish caucus. So we've had identity caucuses before, but we had a pretty massive Jewish caucus this time around that was led by Jewish Voice for Peace. And they were actually really integral in pretty much leading and organizing our security at the conference to make sure that students feel safe and aren't harassed and they ultimately did end up getting verbally harassed, at least by all the kind of protesters, but they were meticulous in helping us organize the conference and making sure our students feel safe. So I think we kind of responded to that city council resolution by, one, ignoring it, and two, making sure that our relationship with our allies is stronger than ever.
You mentioned that there were counter protesters performing, you know, this manufactured outrage at the conference. These kinds of so-called protests are organized, as you mentioned, by right-wing, heavily financed Israel lobby groups, usually off-campus ones, that are bent on spying on, harassing, and slandering student supporters of Palestinian rights.
Yeah.
And if you watch the Lobby USA, the censored Al Jazeera documentary on the lobby that the Electronic Intifada helped to publish, we saw how these kinds of protests are orchestrated by these outside groups. Can you talk about the protests that were organized outside the conference and if they were able to scare students away?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite terrifying. And the problem started even before the conference. So a couple of groups on that arrived onto campus, reservists on duty in Yad Vashem, and these are, like you said, right-wing, you know, really powerfully backed up in terms of the kind of political power they have and lobbying power they have. And they just come, I mean, they have one purpose. And I'm a graduate of UCLA as well. So I was a part of the organization there, UCLA's JP. So I was able to kind of see what they do and what their MO is from a while back. And a big part of what they do is they come onto campus and they disrupt student events. They make students feel safe, and nobody wants to be part of events where people are, you know, yelling and there's a lot of commotion or whatever going on. So their single MO is to come and make sure that they somehow get the environment to be as aggressive as possible. And I think that's kind of their aim with what happened at the conference. But before the conference, they ended up coming to campus where there was a protest against anti-Semitism, which was essentially conflated to be a protest against NSGP. And they ended up physically assaulting visibly Muslim women, UCLA students from the Muslim Student Association at UCLA. And that's kind of when we started getting worried, because it was 3 or 4 days before the conference. And it was a really big deal. Someone was basically like hit and spit on and assaulted. And we knew that they were prominent organizers of the counter protest. And I think that was made very clear to us as well. And I think we wanted to really, really make sure our students don't feel like they can't be safe on campus, even though we have all of the security protocols and stuff in place. So really what ended up happening was, you know, we had over 500 students on campus, and if you put everybody together at the conference, you know, all of the organizers, even some of the older movement members, we would probably have around like 600 people at the conference. And all of these people at points had to move between buildings. So every time we were moving, it was kind of like The Walking Dead, where we would be surrounded by these protesters that were extremely aggressive. And all our students were trying to do from one building to the other, and they were just walking. And that's all we were trying to do, just get from one workshop to the other. And the crowd of protesters would throw things, scream extremely vile things that we kind of talked about in our statement. Really, really dangerous, incredibly racist, Islamophobic remarks. All of their signboards pretty much read, terrorists or these students are terrorists, SJP is full of terrorists, something like that. And then I actually was on the perimeter. So NSGP steering made sure that we were on the perimeter and trying to protect students. And I got spit on by a group of the protesters. I also saw like other elected representatives there. We saw Paul Koretz there. So they were actively part of this counter protest. And it ended up being really vile and really threatening and really dangerous. And our students, I mean, all we were trying to do is just get from one building to the other. And at the end, what ended up also happening is two or three members of that counter protest that were from, not necessarily from UCLA, but they were from off campus, Zionist student organizations, SSI, Students Supporting Israel, that somehow just got into the conference, into a closed space, into a closed safe space that was supposed to be for our students, started filming us. They got up on stage and started filming students. And we know how dangerous that is because students, you know, there's blacklists out there that make it so hard for students who are supporting Palestine to organize because it's, you know, it trails us everywhere. All this false information trails us everywhere. And they smear us and they make accusations about who we are and what we do, post a lot of our private information online. So now there were these students that barged in and just filmed students. And I think students were extremely terrified and scared that their faces were going to be plastered over the internet. And this is a very real threat. And it's happened last year at the conference, which is why we were so big on security. We found wiretaps under chairs in workshops. And I mean, we're just students. We don't have, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to have high-tech security to make sure everything's clean and everything's secure. So we just kind of do our best. We make sure the rooms are secure. But we discovered at the last year's conference that some of the workshop rooms were tapped. And they ended up recording one of my sessions was completely recorded, posted online like moments later. I don't even know how, but we kind of realized that this was a very real threat. The students are always going to be, you know, filmed without their consent, recorded without their consent. Cameras are going to be thrust in their face without their consent. And that, like, people just don't care. Like, these counter protesters just don't care how unsafe they make us feel. And no matter how hard we try to protect ourselves against this very real threat, things kind of always seem to happen. So I think this year we tried our best. There were no incidents at the conference in terms of students getting hurt, which I think was a big success given how violent and aggressive the counter-protest was and the stuff they were yelling at us and berating us. I think it was incredible that our students were able to just focus on the conference and not, you know, not get involved in anything other than that. And I think they were just trying to, you know, put on a good conference and just focus. And I think it was incredible that we pulled that off.
That's the voice of Aisha Khan of National Students for Justice in Palestine. Aisha, I'm assuming that Chancellor Jean Block was also very disturbed by the aggressiveness of the counter-protesters and obviously issued a statement supporting his students and their safety, right?
No. I think admin were there at the conference. There were a lot of admin present. We had vice chancellors present. We had events and facilities managers present. And I know for a fact it was very clear to them how imbalanced the situation was, just kind of like the dynamic there is between oppressor and oppressed and colonizer and colonized. And that dynamic was so clear and apparent, I think, at the conference, because we had a group of largely students of color and just trying to put on a conference where they're talking about not just Palestine, so many different things, and trying to find intersectionality between all of these complicated social justice issues that we care about because they affect our communities. And we were trying to have a conference, and across the street, there's a group of people that are just yelling terrorists. And I think that irony and that parallel between what was going on and how that's a microcosm of how brown and black people are treated for fighting for their communities and for believing in any kind of resistance it was very apparent to admin. And I know for a fact that they saw all of the vile things that they were saying, all of the incidents, they definitely saw these students infiltrate, walk in with cameras, trying to film people. So they're aware of how hard it is for us to even exist on campuses, how hard it is for us to pull off a national conference where we can bring together students from different parts of the country. And I'm just disappointed that Chancellor Block found the need to write an op-ed somehow basically just saying that, yeah, students have their, you know, Palestine is not the exception to free speech, but he didn't say that. He just said that, yeah, I should have this conference because, you know, why not? But then also in the same letter defamed us without ever having reached out to us at all, or SJP-UCLA was never reached out to by Jean Block. But at the same time, he's very aware of what happened at the conference. He's very aware of things that were said. He is very aware of how vile and aggressive the counter-protest was because admin were lined up watching it happen. And we never got a letter. We never got an email. We never got reached out to after. And I think it's very clear how biased this whole approach is that university administrations take.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakut, our music maker and production assistant.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Burroughs of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, who examines the Trump administration's threat to withdraw from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia and the likely consequences of a new nuclear arms race. Independent journalist Dave Lindorf, who discusses his recent Nation magazine investigation into the Pentagon's shady and likely unconstitutional budgeting practices. And Lori Sweet, a Connecticut mother who's sheltering immigrants in her home, talks about her recent trip to the border area, where more than 2,000 immigrant children are being detained in a tent city in the Texas desert. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Tensions between Russia and Ukraine escalated on November the 25th as Russian Coast Guard ships seized three Ukrainian military vessels and their crews. They were attempting to pass from the Black Sea through the Kerch Strait into the Azov Sea on their way to the Ukrainian port of Mariupol. Six Ukrainian crew members were injured in the clash, and 24 Ukrainian sailors from the captured ships were detained by Russia. After the naval clash, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko imposed martial law in parts of the country, an action that many observers say was calculated to boost his chance to win re-election in next year's March the 31st national ballot. Critics of Vladimir Putin say new Moscow sanctions targeting Ukraine's anti-Russian politicians are designed to assist pro-Russia candidates in the election. But, as the Christian Science Monitor reports, very little attention has been paid to the consequences of the economic conflict between the two nations, which has caused far more destruction than sanctions imposed by the West on Russia after the Kremlin annexed Crimea in 2014. Although Russia remains Ukraine's largest trading partner, a tit-for-tat sanctions war between Russia and Ukraine has caused trade to collapse by two-thirds over the past 5 years. Some 4 million Ukrainians, or 16% of the working-age population, have left the country to find work abroad. Ironically, many of them go to Russia, where they now number about 2 million. An important bipartisan criminal justice reform bill, known as the First Step Act, could die in the U.S. Senate. Although President Trump, along with progressive politicians and national groups, support the bill, in recent days, right-wing GOP Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas has lobbied aggressively against the bill, and Florida's Republican Senator Marco Rubio said that he has concerns about the sentencing reform provisions. Cotton describes the First Step Act as a jailbreak that would endanger communities by allowing violent criminals to leave prison. But those concerns aren't based on reality, according to supporters of the bill. Ames Growatt, an attorney at the Brennan Center for Justice, maintains that the real interest in the bill is that it addresses some of the most punitive drug sentences and over the long term helps reduce racial disparities in prisons. Thus far, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has refused to bring the prison reform bill up for a vote. During a closed-door meeting among Republican senators, Vice President Mike Pence called for Republicans to support the reform bill. Trump ally Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina says he believes 80 senators would vote for the legislation if the legislation is allowed to move to a vote on the Senate floor. Generations of immigrants coming to the United States have, to get ahead, relied on informal saving circles outside of mainstream banks and financial institutions. and Kem Kumba arrived from the West African nation of Cameroon in 1990 to get an education. He gave $300 a month to a saving circle called an Ajangi. A year later, he got a loan to buy a car. Today, he is a lecturer at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. These peer-to-peer savings networks are more formally known as Rotating Savings and Credit Associations, or ROSCAs. As In These Times magazine reports, these associations are common in many developing nations who lack access to Western-style banks. In an example of how these groups work, 10 people will commit to saving $100 a month, then, each month, one person in the group will receive all the money collected. ROSCAs, which rely on trust among the group members, charge neither interest nor fees on loans made. While banks are widely used in the United States and Europe, over 1.7 billion people across the globe don't have a bank account, and high interest rates and fees keep credit out of reach for many of the world's poorest people. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Withdrawing from international agreements has been a familiar theme in the first 2 years of the Trump presidency. On June 1st last year, Donald Trump announced that he was withdrawing the United States from the Paris Climate Accord that united virtually every nation in the world to combat the dangerous effects of climate change. Then on May 8th this year, Mr. Trump stated that he was reneging on the U.S. commitment to abide by the international Iran nuclear deal, which had successfully frozen that nation's nuclear weapons program. More recently, the Trump White House revealed that it intended to withdraw the U.S. from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, signed by President Ronald Reagan and then Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev in 1987. The treaty has succeeded in preventing the deployment of destabilizing U.S. and Russian missiles on the European continent over the last 30 years. President Trump charges that the Russians are violating the terms of the INF Treaty by building and deploying an intermediate-range missile, the Novator 9M729, which exceeds the treaty's range limitation of 310 to 3,420 miles. The Russians counter that the U.S. has defied the agreement by deploying an anti-missile system in Eastern Europe that can be used offensively against Russia. On December 4th, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo issued an ultimatum to Russia that if it didn't comply with the treaty in 60 days, the U.S. would withdraw. Your reporter spoke with John Burroughs, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, who discusses his group's campaign to preserve the INF Treaty and prevent a new U.S.-Russia nuclear arms race.
The announcement in October seemed to be a case of John Bolton, who was against any kind of international law, whispering in Trump's ear U.S. concerns about a Russian intermediate range missile go back well into the Obama administration, and they've been trying to work it out with the Russians for 4 or 5 years now. And the understanding prior to Trump's announcement was basically that that effort would continue. The Director of National Intelligence just released a report, which is the first time we've seen anything public about U.S. claims. And they're saying that Russia indeed has deployed missiles that violate the INF Treaty in Russia. They didn't give numbers, but others have said it could be, you know, a couple of hundred, and that they could threaten both Europe and Asia with nuclear or conventionally armed missiles. And the INF treaty covers both. Mostly arms control supporting experts have said, Yes, Russia is violating the treaty, but we need to just work hard to bring them back into compliance. The very same thing was done with a radar installation that the Soviet Union had that was violative of the ABM treaty. And critics go on to say that it doesn't make sense for the U.S. to deploy missiles that would violate the INF treaty. There's no need for them. The U.S. has other capabilities. The Allies wouldn't accept having them based on their territory. So why leave a treaty if you're not going to test and deploy something that would violate it?
The Russians, in responding to Trump's intention to withdraw from the INF treaty, say that the U.S. anti-missile systems that have been deployed in Eastern Europe and armed U.S. drones are similarly a violation of the INF treaty. Your comment on that?
Well, first of all, I have to say, Scott, you have really researched this. Very good. Yes, the Romanian missile defense deployment of the U.S. and the planned Polish one drive the Russians crazy. The Russians believe that the missile defense systems, which the U.S. claims are to protect against an Iranian potential capability, that they are really aimed at Russia. So that doesn't come within the letter of the INF treaty, but it does show kind of the underlying problem, which is that the Russians feel that in numerous ways, the United States has not held up what the Russians thought was a post-Cold War settlement. No NATO expansion, no pursuit of offensive capabilities that could threaten the other country's survival. So I would speculate, and you know, this is speculation only, that the Russian deployments of the missiles the U.S. says violate the INF treaty may have been directly driven by the Romanian missile defense and the planned Polish installation.
John, today, so many years after those major protests of the 1980s, the peace movement, the anti-nuclear arms race movement, is really at a low ebb. Do you have any hope that people across the country dealing with many, many other issues in the age of Trump will be focused enough to put pressure on the Senate and President Trump to influence what happens here with the intention to pull out of the INF treaty?
I'm not necessarily looking for a revival of, 1980-style freeze movement. But what I would like to see and what I think is really possible is for nuclear arms control and disarmament advocacy to be integrated with the advocacy on other issues that people do, whether it's racial justice, climate protection, and so on. And I think that is very much possible.
That was John Burroughs, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. Find more analysis and commentary on the INF Treaty by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Although Congress ordered all government agencies to undergo federal audits in the 1990s, the Defense Department, which takes in more tax dollars by far than any other government department, had for the past 25 years stubbornly refused to comply. However, after 1,200 accountants and analysts recently completed a first-time year-long inspection of the Pentagon's books, all but two sections of the massive agency failed the audit, which means that money spent and assets purchased couldn't be properly accounted for. It's ironic that as the U.S. has accumulated a record deficit, the Pentagon, with a current fiscal year 2018 budget of about $700 billion, asks for ever greater amounts of money that it can't seem to responsibly track. Your reporter spoke with Dave Lindorf, an award-winning independent journalist who recently completed an investigation of the Pentagon audit findings for The Nation magazine. His article, titled "The Pentagon's Massive Accounting Fraud Exposed," found that the Defense Department has routinely employed accounting tricks to make it appear that the military needs and spends more money than it actually does. Lindorf contends that the Pentagon's misleading accounting practices has accumulated as much as $100 billion in an unaccountable slush fund.
The Pentagon has not been audited since the act was passed in 1990, requiring all agencies to have auditable budgets and to be audited every year. And, you know, the funny thing is they always have been giving the excuse that, we have these legacy systems that don't talk to each other, you know, and stuff. But they've been saying that since back when I was using a K-Pro computer. And, you know, they get so much money. They could have bought several Watson computers from IBM and done the whole thing, you know. What I was told by my sources, some on the record, some not on the record, that is that the Pentagon doesn't want to be audited and has not wanted to be audited, and that this is all about not being audited. So Congress finally threw up its hands and said, all right, we're going to do this, and they voted for a $900 million audit, bringing in these top firms this year to do the 2018 budget, the big E&Y and PricewaterhouseCoopers and so on, to audit the Pentagon. And they had an army of 1,200 guys, women and men, going through the Pentagon books, auditing it. And they produced on November 15th their results, which were, we can't do this. They said the numbers were so confusing and obtuse and obscure or obscurantist that they said they could not do an audit. They could only come up with a list of thousands of deficiencies that have to be fixed before they can even do an audit, and that that's going to take years because the numbers are so screwy and you need prior year reliable, you know, documents in order to do a current year audit. So it's going to be years, even if the Pentagon really wants to have an audit. And since it really doesn't want to have an audit, it could take even longer. So there we are with this unit of government that accounts for 54% of every tax dollar that people spend or pay. And it can't, we can't tell how they spend their money. And not only that, then my story was about how they've been making up the numbers in their financial statements out of whole cloth. So they aren't even real numbers. And their own internal agency, the Office of Inspector General, has continually complained that the numbers are made up and don't have any supporting ledger documents to back them up. And yet it continues to happen year after year, and nobody gets fired, nobody gets indicted, nothing.
Well, Dave, we're almost out of time. I wanted to ask you, is there any chance that the incoming Democratic majority in the House of Representatives will have a different relationship with the Pentagon, more scrutiny, holding their feet to the fire, and demanding answers about how taxpayer dollars are being spent or wasted or abused?
Sadly, I would say no, just because, you know, maybe a few progressives have been elected who are anti-military. But let's face it, the Democrats have been as much of a war party as the Republicans and have been, you know, very generous at funding the Pentagon over the years. So, I mean, just on this story, I tried for months to get a comment on it from Senator Sanders and never got even a callback. And we tried through sources at The Nation, you know, my editor, Mark Hertzgard, a great editor who really worked hard on this piece, said, oh, we'll get Sanders. You know, The Nation's really friends with Sanders. Nope, didn't work. Even tried John Nichols to make contact, and it didn't work. He ducked it. I've been trying to get Tulsi Gabbard, and so far haven't gotten a call back even from her press office. And she's one of the, you know, more daring critics of the Pentagon.
One of the most alarming pieces of information I found in your piece was the existence of some kind of $100 billion slush fund that the Pentagon has through creative, quote-unquote, accounting, which you say likely funds foreign operations below the radar without congressional authorization. Say a quick word about that, if you would.
Yeah, this happened actually in 1980s, and Spinney told me about it. They had a fund that was based on falsely estimating the amount of
expected inflation. They were using a 30% estimate, and then when they wouldn't have that kind of inflation, they were pocket the difference, which quickly added up to about $100 billion, and they tucked it away in places that it couldn't be found, and then he thinks it got used for funding Iran-Contra and other things. And he suspects, and so do others that I talked to, that the same thing is happening here, where they're saying they're spending all the money each year and getting more, but they aren't actually spending all the money. And then they do something called nippering, where they cut out pieces of money. They reclassify one-year money that's supposed to be returned to Congress if it's not spent, turn it into five-year money that's for, you know, things like weapons projects, and then hide it. And it builds up, and then they have it without any oversight because nobody knows it's there. That's very dangerous.
That was Dave Lindorf, an award-winning independent journalist and author of the recent Nation magazine investigation titled "The Pentagon's Massive Accounting Fraud Exposed." Find a link to this Pentagon investigation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Many in the U.S. have been outraged by Donald Trump's rhetoric and his administration's treatment of Central American migrants as they journeyed through Mexico and approached the U.S. southern border. During the midterm election campaign, Trump repeatedly referred to them as invaders and criminals. Once groups of migrants traveling in caravans for safety and visibility actually arrived at the border in Tijuana, they camped out in fields and across town, waiting to be interviewed for their asylum claims, which has happened extremely slowly, if at all. At one point, a smaller group of migrants rushed the border fence and were repelled with tear gas, affecting some mothers and their young children. Most of those in the caravan are fleeing poverty, violence, and the ravages of climate change-induced drought that has made farming nearly impossible. Though many have been angry about the situation on the border, many fewer have taken concrete action in solidarity with the migrants. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with one person who decided to take action, Lori Sweet, a mother of two from Connecticut. She's taken a mother, father, and baby into her home after they were released from immigration custody and is now assisting them to pursue their asylum claims. Here, Lori talks about a trip she took to the El Paso, Texas border area with a group Immigrant Families Together in mid-November to assist other asylum seekers. There she also witnessed the situation where more than 2,300 immigrant children are being detained in a tent city in the middle of the Texas desert.
It was really important for me to see El Paso, to see the border, to work with other asylum seekers as they're being processed through the detention center so that I felt like I've seen the whole process. Not to say that I've walked in their shoes by any means, but maybe have a better sense of what they've experienced from waiting in El Paso. They're waiting at the border. There's border patrol and they can't get in and they're living on bridges. And this is happening all across our borders in the South. So I wanted to see that for myself. That was the first thing that we did was a walk in and out of Mexico. I did not walk in and out of Mexico because I didn't have my passport, but I watched and I heard about what that was like. And the next step was to get on a bus and go about 30, 40 minutes south of El Paso into the middle of nowhere, Texas, Tornillo, where approximately 2,300 unaccompanied minors are living. And judging by Josh Rubin, who is just another person like me who's living there, set up an RV and is observing and watching, those numbers are growing by the day. 2,300 is the numbers we are told. But having been there and having done a rally right outside the tents, I can tell you I saw in an hour, I saw three buses, pretty full buses of children waving at us. They're bringing in more tent supplies. They're bringing in water, porta potties, that kind of stuff. So this isn't something that is temporary and going to go away. This is expanding. And that was hugely traumatic to see, to say the least.
We should point out, Lori Sweet, that these young people being held at Tornillo are between the ages of 13 and 17 and crossed the border without their family members, right?
we're told they crossed unaccompanied, but we're still separating families, and it's possible they came with other relatives, and that the families that I've been working with, it's often an aunt or an uncle, well, they're getting their own children out of detention centers, so they can't always sponsor those children. And there's rigorous background checks on moms and dads to get their own children. They have to be fingerprinted, and everybody in the household has to be fingerprinted. And yet, the people who are staffed in the tents of Tornillo do not have to be fingerprinted. But in order for you to get your own child, you're subjected to fingerprinting. This is new, and it's a lengthy process, and it's causing further delays. And I just, you know, the thing that I want to emphasize is that these children haven't done anything wrong. They've been traumatized in their country of origin. They've been traumatized on their trip here, and we're traumatizing them further. And they aren't criminals. They haven't done anything wrong. They're not allowed to hug each other. They're not allowed to hug the staff. They're sorely understaffed for mental health clinicians. That concerns me, too. I feel like we're torturing children, and I feel like people need to know what's happening, where our money, our tax money is going, and we need to stop it.
The fact that they're doing this really inadequate screening of staff is really scary. The Trump administration has basically said that they wouldn't process anyone who didn't cross at a border crossing. And then a judge ruled that that isn't the case and that they have to take people however they cross. But when people rushed the border and were met with tear gas, I don't know if any of the people rushing the border were women and children. Maybe they were all the men. But what do you say to people who say, well, that's total chaos and everybody should respect borders? What do you think law enforcement people should have done instead? Just let everybody in?
No, I don't think everybody should be let in. I understand why we have the rules that we do. We don't want gang members coming into our country. We don't want people coming in that are going to human traffic along our borders. However, we have created this crisis. And the reason that those folks in San Diego were rushing the border is that they closed the port of entry. So anybody who wants to say, well, they have to come in the legal way is to go to a port of entry along our U.S. border and present yourself as an asylum seeker and say, I'm here for asylum. The reason there was such mass chaos at the border is that those people had been waiting there, living on the streets in Mexico for days, and they were not allowed entry. It is completely illegal what we're doing. The same thing's happening in El Paso. The same thing's happening in Brownsville. Sometimes they only get three people or no people who are allowed to cross into the United States. That's illegal. It is a legal human right to ask for asylum, period. And we can bolster our walls if that would make people feel better, and they are, and we can put barbed wire on top of the walls. But you have to still let people in, because to not let people in is a human rights violation.
That was Lori Sweet, a Connecticut mother who's sheltering immigrants in her home who are seeking asylum in the U.S. Learn more about the ways in which people are assisting immigrants in this time of crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPM in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines,
I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Big Man Howard. His name was Elbert Howard, but few people called him that. To his friends and comrades in the Black Panther Party, he was Big Man because he really was a big man. Built like a football player. He was one of six men who originally joined and built the Black Panther Party, and he rose to Deputy Minister of Information, and for a time, he edited the Black Panther newspaper. He was born and raised in Chattanooga, Tennessee, but after he was discharged from the Air Force, he stayed in California. His impressive size and build, plus an impressive afro, made him a photogenic figure of a Panther. But he was, in fact, a soft-spoken man, albeit matter-of-fact. When most of the party co-founders were in prison or on trial, Big Man stepped into the gap and tell the party story. He was an able, talented editor and writer, and, when necessary, speaker. Elbert Big Man Howard returned to his ancestors recently after 80 years of life. Elbert Big Man Howard, Deputy Minister of Information, the Black Panther Party, all power to the people. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. In 1952, a political scientist named Richard Hofstadter published a book that would become a classic, The Paranoid Style in American Politics. In the preface, former U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower is quoted for privately criticizing the far right as stupid. He also predicted that if that small percentage of the Republican Party ever prevailed, it would spell the end of that party. Hofstadter recounts the history of American political paranoia, from early enmity against Catholics, then the Jews, then the other late immigrants to America. It's been over 60 years since his and Eisenhower's predictions, and today's GOP is about as far right as it gets. The president has driven it further to the right, and it seems to get more aggressive than ever. We may be seeing the beginning of the demise of the Republicans or the rise of a Trumpian party. History, it seems, doesn't always agree to predictions of the past. For history, unlike science, doesn't move in straight lines. History gives new life to old ideas, moves in circles, or sometimes gets trapped in cul-de-sac. No one really knows what tomorrow may bring. History sometimes surprises us in tragedy or fun. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Attacking Latino immigrants from Guatemala and Honduras, lobbing tear gas canisters at moms and babies. This, after knowingly separating children from their parents, a gruesome stunt meant to intimidate Latinos and to draw simple human compassion away from them. Governments have traditionally turned immigrants into scapegoats, making them the latest targets of racist enmity. King Donald I called them bad dudes, criminals, and gang members. Yeah, gangsters in diapers, right? Here's what it really is. Class war. The poor versus the poor. Workers against workers. Divide and conquer. This ain't even an American thing. It's a capitalist thing. Rulers in Europe, America, and Latin America are using the power of fear to turn worker against worker. When politicians sell and spread the toxin of fear, it's time for workers to join with their fellow workers to unite and fight for all. The politics of capitalism are the politics of division, of class war, of dog-eat-dog, and of pushing people against each other instead of for each other. America remains the prison house of nations. It has 5% of the world's population and 24% of the world's prisoners. The United States is the imprisonator-in-chief of this planet. On the bright side, we celebrate the release of Debbie and Mike Africa of the MOVE organization after 40 years in prison. But that brief bright light reveals the horror of the system of shackles, chains, and handcuffs. That light shows us the injustice of the continued imprisonment of Leonard Peltier, a Lakota Native American activist in American federal prisons. So, before I go, I salute our friends and comrades in Germany. Thank you for what you do for human rights and freedom. On the move from imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
My name is Michael Welch, and you're listening to the Global Research News Hour, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabegakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nihiyawak and the Dakota. Our show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is podcast at the site globalresearch.ca. On the evening of Friday, November 30th, George Herbert Walker Bush passed away at his home in Houston, Texas. On the week the 41st president's funerary rites are being conducted in the nation's capital, political figures and media representatives of all ideological persuasions are expressing solemn platitudes to a man now being hailed for his civility, politeness, courage, and his decency. As president, he presided over the collapse of the Soviet Union, leaving the U.S. the de facto sole superpower. At his state funeral, Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney saluted him for his role in establishing a free trade agreement spanning the three North American countries, for his leadership in the first post-Cold War military conflict that was the Persian Gulf War, and for overseeing the unification of Germany, among other great feats. These accolades, however, distract from a much more critical assessment of his role as a major power broker on the planetary stage. A solid argument can be mustered that George Herbert Walker Bush was not only a war criminal, through and through, but he engaged in activities overt and clandestine that would have repercussions for the world we witness today. This week's episode of the Global Research News Hour intends to review that legacy and examine what this more detailed and hopefully more accurate assessment of the man's life and background says about perennial systemic relations that continue to dominate the political and geopolitical playing field in the new century. On this week's program, Soldier Statesman or Criminal War Profiteer, A People's History of George H.W. Bush. One of the greatest controversies surrounding George Bush was reporting that his father, Prescott, had dealings with the Nazis before and during the war. Specifically, Prescott Bush was a managing director of United Banking Corporation, which functioned as a clearinghouse for the business enterprises and assets of one Fritz Thyssen, the steel and coal magnate and industrialist who is said to have been Adolf Hitler's original patron in the early 30s and to have financed the Nazi war machine. The business relationship between the Nazis' military-industrial activities and Prescott Bush was extensive, if the archival record can be believed. John Loftus, a former U.S. Justice Department war crimes prosecutor, began researching and exposing U.S. recruitment of Nazi war criminals in 1981. He has argued that the substantial fortune earned by the Bush family through UBC came from the Third Reich. He said that Prescott Bush and his colleagues directly profited from the slave labor of those who died at Auschwitz and the steel that killed Allied soldiers. Another important figure who revealed these links between the Bushes and Nazis was John Buchanan. He's an award-winning investigative reporter and freelance journalist. He'd authored articles in the fall of 2003 based on his unearthing of recently declassified documents in the National Archives and the Library of Congress, proving the treasonous partnership, which extended
until well after the war, with virtually no consequences for Prescott Bush or his progeny. John Buchanan joined us recently to break down what the documents reveal and why the revelations matter to this day.
Prescott Bush's father-in-law was George Herbert Walker, for whom the recently deceased President George H.W. Bush is named. And Walker's Point, the place in Maine where the Bush family has vacationed for several decades, is actually named for George Herbert Walker. So George Herbert Walker, in 1923, with W. Averill Harriman, who would go on to be Under Secretary of State and then Governor of New York State, they made a trip to Germany looking for new business opportunities for the investment, the Wall Street investment bank Brown Brothers Harriman. And they met with Fritz Thyssen, who at the time was one of the wealthiest men in Germany and dominated the German coal and steel industries, and they made a deal to become his essentially investment bank on Wall Street in the U.S., and it just grew out from there. And so when Prescott Bush was courting George Herbert Walker's daughter and George H.W. Bush's mother, George Herbert Walker wanted him to be more successful and have a better life and so on. And so he brought him in to Brown Brothers Harriman. And then as that relationship progressed into the 1930s, they founded a company called United Banking Corporation, known as UBC. And it was not a bank. It was essentially a holding company for what turned out to be a wide range of Nazi enterprises, all owned by Fritz Thyssen, or in some instances, some of his colleagues, like Frederick Flick, who was a co-owner of IG Farben, the company that operated the death camps for the Nazis.
Now, there was also another bank involved in this whole setup, based in Holland, am I not mistaken?
That was Thyssen's bank located in Holland, that essentially sort of, for lack of a better term in terms of the language we use today, essentially served as a money laundering operation to be able to siphon stuff through that bank into and out of the U.S. That's correct.
Now, the it was in the summer of 1942, I believe, where the Congress had to take aggressive actions.
Yeah, well, what happened was a great newspaper of the era, the New York Herald Tribune, on July 30th, 1942, and the key thing, obviously, there is that the U.S. had already entered the war and was fighting Germany at that time. And so on July 30th, 1942, the New York Herald Tribune broke the story under the headline, "Hitler's Angel Has $3 Million in U.S. Bank." But that was just scratching the surface, and even that article did not yet know all of the details of how extensive the network of Nazi businesses under the banner of United Banking Corp was. But as a result of that article, the U.S. government started seizing the assets. So the first thing they seized was United Banking Corporation, under the what at the time was known as the Trading with the Enemy Act. And then after that, they seized another half dozen businesses, including a shipping line called Hamburg America Line, and a number of other major assets.
But there was the network was so extensive that even though they were able to seize those companies, according to your own report, the Bush and his colleagues were able to maintain those financial benefits up until 1951.
Correct, and extensively lie about it. In my second story in the New Hampshire Gazette, which was just about the fact that after all of the seizures in 1942 and 1943, the Nazi dealings continued until 1951. So when I went back on my own for a second trip to the National Archives and Library of Congress, that's when I found all of those documents. And, yeah, that's it exactly, and they lied about it. I have in my second story, you know, FBI memoranda about the lies they told. And you have to remember we're talking about Brown Brothers Harriman, you know, at the time the most prominent and powerful investment bank on Wall Street, almost the equivalent of, you know, Morgan Stanley today. And they consistently lied and covered up and destroyed evidence. So when I was breaking my stories, I contacted Brown Brothers Harriman, and the PR person at Brown Brothers Harriman, needless to say, was pretty shocked to find out that I had the documents. And to say he was uncooperative would be an understatement. And it turns out they also destroyed all of the documents back then, so nothing exists.
I think, as you're pointing out, the ability to cover up this story seems to be more, or at least as interesting and shocking as the revelations themselves.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and then I'll tell you the most shocking point to me of them all, and it's particularly, again, relevant to, you know, all the years since, and particularly now. But one of the documents I found was an FBI memorandum, and it was from a supervisory FBI agent to his supervisor in the Justice Department. And the memo was about the fact, and I'm broadly paraphrasing here, but this is literally, you know, what the memo said. And it said, we've come up with all of this very damaging information about a very powerful American family. What am I supposed to do with it? And he apparently never got any response, and it just kind of went away. And then later on, there was another FBI memorandum that essentially said, we are aware of the individuals involved in this matter, but currently there are no plans to pursue it.
John Buchanan was inspired to investigate claims he had heard about President Bush Sr.'s father, Prescott, as having profited from slave labor at Auschwitz during World War II through a company known as Silesian Steel Corporation. Skeptical, he decided to go to Washington to examine documents in the National Archives.
I knew I was looking for vesting order number 242, which was the document used to seize UBC under the Trading with the Enemy Act. So it took me, you know, 5 minutes to find stuff related to vesting order 242. And then I cross-referenced into a bunch of other stuff and cross-referenced it to Fritz Thiessen and things like that. So you put together a list of the various documents that you want. And then the archivist goes in the back and just brings out these boxes on a cart, right? So I just start going through them. And on the very first day, I amassed probably at least 150 or 200 pages of stuff that confirmed all of the, you know, basic stuff that we've been talking about. And what's cool about the process at both the National Archives and the Library of Congress is that when you make copies, they're authenticated with a watermark as being from the National Archives, so nobody can challenge them or call them fake or whatever.
As John Buchanan examined the material, he initially came to realize he was in way over his head and at first decided to simply hand the materials over to one of the major media outlets asking only that he be named as having unearthed the incriminating documents. Buchanan recounts their reaction.
So I call the New York Times, no response. I call the Washington Post, no response. I call CNN, ABC News, CBS News, NBC News. Not interested. So I call the New York Times back, and I forget his name, but the bureau chief at the time of the Washington Bureau of the New York Times actually, I said, look, I'm just going to come to the New York Times office and drop them off in the lobby, et cetera. And he threatened to have me arrested if I showed up. Now, to this day, I don't know why that was. The only logical explanation I can think of is he must have thought I was delusional or something. But it still perplexes me that he wouldn't take the risk of at least looking at the documents, right?
And there was another editor, I think it was for the Miami Herald, that had...
The editor of the Miami Herald at the time. He and I had numerous phone conversations before he ended up accusing me of stalking him. He wouldn't look at him.
Well, once your story came out in the Gazette, the Associated Press did end up kind of picking up on it, but not in a way that you were particularly satisfied with.
Yeah, they watered it way down. Their story was essentially, and the headline essentially was Prescott Bush served on board of Nazi Bank, and they left out all the good stuff. And the guy, Jonathan Salant, the Associated Press reporter who did the story, you know, I called him up. At the time, he was the president of the National Press Club, and I called him up. And he, to his credit, he did give me credit at the end of the story for, you know, discovering the documents, right? So I called him up and I said, Jonathan, you know, what happened to the rest of the story? The fact that he was on the board of a company has nothing to do with anything that I reported. And believe it or not, and again, I stress, I'm a freelance guy from Florida, and we're talking about a big-time reporter for the Associated Press. Right? He goes, well, I wasn't able to confirm everything you said. And I said, well, Jonathan, I don't know how that's possible since I'm a schmuck from Florida and you work for AP, but if you want to buy me a plane ticket to Washington, I'll gladly take you through everything so you can see it. And, of course, he didn't take me up on the offer.
What do you make of that apparent lack of curiosity?
Oh, I have no doubt about it at this point. Bear in mind, we're talking about, you know, this was 15 years ago, right? I learned the hard way, and boy, do I mean the hard way, that there are certain stories that are never going to see the light of day in the U.S., and the cover-up is thorough and complete, and anyone who tries to persist in getting that story out is going to pay a heavy, heavy price, as you know I did.
Okay, well, what brings me to my next question, though. What happened to you?
When the story first came out, two things happened. Number one, it was picked up by like 400 websites all over the world within probably 48 hours, and a lot of pretty well-known leftist websites in the U.S. like Rents.com and stuff. And then I immediately got death threats. So I answer my phone one night, living on Miami Beach, and a voice goes, John Buchanan, 4100 Collins Avenue, apartment 507, Miami Beach. You won't live to see the news tomorrow morning. So I freak out. So I call the Miami Beach police. I forget what happened and how it happened, but the police came over to my apartment and fairly quickly, somehow or other, you know, vouched for the fact this was a fairly serious threat. And so the Miami Beach police gave me police protection for like 72 hours. And there was like cop cars in front of my apartment building and a cop in the hallway outside my door. And then, you know, that went away. And then, you know, after that, there was a person who was a British, supposedly former journalist and now PR person who I had written an old article about because he was a promoter in the music business in South Beach, Miami. So I knew him through that. Now, his name was Jeremy Labor, L-E-B-O-R. So he claimed he had all these big-time PR connections, et cetera. And so I called him up and asked him, you know, told him what I had and asked him if he would be interested in helping me. So immediately he goes, I'm going to get you on Larry King. I've got top-notch connections in London. I'll get you on TV in London, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he turned out to be completely full of you-know-what. So I had given him the documents for safekeeping, and he stole them. He wouldn't give them back. I go down to the police station to file my report that, you know, this guy stole my documents and I want them back. And the detective, a detective and a female cop, you know, come into the room where I'm sitting, and right off the bat, the cop says, you know he's very afraid of you, right? And I said, excuse me? And he goes, he says you've been making death threats against him. And I said, that's ridiculous. I'm a journalist. I don't make death threats. I've been trying to get my documents back. What do I have to fill out to have you go get my documents back, et cetera? And he goes, well, it's not that simple. He's filed a police complaint against you, and he's seeking a restraining order. And I said, man, you got to be kidding me. You have to be kidding me. And he goes, no, this is a very serious matter. So like a week later, there's a knock on the door, and I get served by the police to go to court for a restraining order. I go to court, and he gets a restraining order against me.
The same month John Buchanan's articles began appearing in the Gazette, he got a call from Bob Fertig, an operator of a Democrat Party website and a Nazi history enthusiast. He'd encouraged John, then a registered Democrat, to run for president on the Republican Party ticket as an anti-war candidate, as a way of bringing more public attention to the Bush family Nazi links. John agreed to the plan and ended up running in the New Hampshire primary in January of 2004 as one of 14 so-called fringe candidates against incumbent President Bush. According to his own account, Buchanan managed to secure 873 Republican votes along with conducting a number of interviews. Following the primaries, he was invited to fly down to the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. to discuss his success at the primaries and his convictions about Bush-Nazi links. Anticipating a short and interesting deviation from before returning to New Hampshire and ultimately catching a train back to Florida, John Buchanan explains what transpired when his plane arrived in Baltimore.
So then this black woman cop from Baltimore Washington Airport comes on the plane, comes up to the doorway of where coach starts, and so she's, you know, six or seven rows away from me, but doesn't know it yet. And she says, will passenger John Buchanan please identify himself? And I go, oh, man, you know, this definitely can't be good. So I put my hand up, and she goes, sir, would you step forward? Now people in the plane are, like, freaking out and thinking I'm some kind of, you know, domestic terrorist or something. And they interrogated me for 2.5 hours and said they had information I was plotting to assassinate Bush.
That's quite shocking. But then again, I mean, I'm not excusing it or anything, but this is around the time when there was a real spike in concern about terrorism. But still, that's a very remarkable point that you're raising.
Oh, yeah, a remarkable timing coincidence, but it gets even weirder. So I go that night. I freaked out when I didn't even check into the hotel reservation that Bob Fertig had made because I was paranoid to even go to my hotel, right? So I went to the National Press Club, like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 4:30 in the afternoon, and then ask if there, you know, where was there a restaurant close by to go get something to eat. I think I was going to speak at like 7 o'clock. So I went to this restaurant around the corner from the National Press Club and then came back and just hid out at the National Press Club until it was, you know, time for me to make my speech. So I make my speech. So a Washington lawyer, and I forget his name, but a Washington lawyer comes up, and I tell the story of the Secret Service. So a Washington lawyer comes up to me after I speak and says, you know, I want to pursue this with you. I'm an attorney, and I don't believe this is legitimate. From your description, I don't believe it was the Secret Service. You know, let's go back to your hotel and make a phone call. And it's like, you know, 9 o'clock at night. So I go, well, I haven't actually checked in yet, but we can go, and I'll check in. So we go to my hotel. We check in. So he has me call the head. He's sitting on my bed. You know, he asked me to call the Secret Service and report in because the two alleged agents had said they wanted to track my whereabouts at all time and I should call them once I've checked into my hotel, right? So I call the Secret Service Washington office and the guy answers the phone. And I go, yeah, my name is John Buchanan. I was interrogated today, you know, blah, 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 blah. And the guy says, sir, you're committing a federal crime. And I said, excuse me, but what crime am I committing? And he goes, we have no information about you in our database. You were not interrogated by Secret Service officers today. And to make up such a story, even to the Secret Service, is a crime. And I went, you got to be kidding me. So the next morning, before I left, I went to the Capitol, and since I had run as a Republican, I go to the Republican office of the House Judiciary Committee, and I just barge in and tell them what I'm there for. So they have these two investigators from the House Judiciary Committee come in and talk to me, and they call the Secret Service, and the Secret Service says they've never heard of me. Then they call Baltimore Washington Airport, and Baltimore Washington Airport says, we have no idea what you're talking about. We didn't take anybody off of an airplane today. So to this day, I can't figure that part out. And the prevailing theory, by the way, that came out in the next, you know, year or two is, you know, this story was just all over the place online. The consensus opinion in the U.S. was that it was probably Karl Rove operating out of the White House to set me up like that, which is certainly possible.
In response to a question about whether George Herbert Walker Bush should take responsibility for his father's financial ties with the Nazis, John Buchanan raised the point that George Bush Sr. took actions to conceal his father's wartime activities. He mentioned he had been contacted by an eminent historian, Herbert Parmet, author of the definitive biography of Prescott Bush. Parmet told Buchanan he was stunned by the documents that had been exposed.
One of the reasons he was stunned was that when he had interviewed Daddy Bush for the biography, George H.W. Bush had categorically denied that any of this stuff was true and said, oh, you know, that's just a bunch of political BS. And then simultaneously with all that, 3 or 4 months before I found the documents, there was a book published that the Bush family paid for. They hired a Houston sports writer named Mickey Herskowitz, and he wrote a book called Duty, Honor, Country, The Life and Legacy of Prescott Bush. And I'm looking at the Amazon page right now for the book, and in the second paragraph it says, you know, all the stuff the book covers, and it says, quote, it also deals honestly with Prescott Bush's alleged business relationships with Nazi industrialists and other accusations. I bought the book, and it is anything but deal honestly with his alleged business relationships with Nazi industrialists, because it basically denies the story. So I do hold him accountable for lying. The exact phrase that Herbert Parmet used was, he looked me right in the eye and lied to me.
Are there implications for this story and the cover-up that followed that has implications beyond the Bush family?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think, again, with the passage of time, you know, over the last 15 years, I think we've seen, you know, multiple examples of it, but the classic one is right now with President Trump and the Saudi government over the murder of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And Trump has literally said repeatedly on the record, you know, I don't want to blow our business deals to sell weapons and stuff to Saudi Arabia just because, you know, he may have been involved in the killing of a journalist. And I think that's the timeless theme of the story, both before, you know, many decades before I ever came along and many decades after I'll be dead, is that war profiteering is probably the biggest industry in the world when you really look at it. It cuts across all party lines and demographic lines and everything else. And then for obvious reason, generally speaking, it needs to be conducted in secrecy and covered up if there's any threat of it becoming public, because I think if the American people or the people of, not so much people of Canada, actually, for obvious reason, but if the American people, you know, ever really knew the total truth of what's been done in this country and by whom, I hope anyway they would be outraged and would take some kind of action to fix the problem. But I'm very pessimistic in that regard, particularly because of what's happened with President Trump over the last couple of weeks about the Khashoggi murder.
That was award-winning investigative reporter and freelance journalist John Buchanan, author of articles appearing in the New Hampshire Gazette in 2003, documenting the links between the Bush family and the Nazi war machine. He's the author of Fixing America, Breaking the Stranglehold of Corporate Rule, Big Media, and the Religious Right, published by Trinday. My name is Michael Welch, and you're listening to a special broadcast of the Global Research News Hour dedicated to the ignoble background of the 41st President of the United States on the occasion of his recent passing. The Global Research News Hour airs on several community and internet radio stations across Canada and the United States and is podcast at the site globalresearch.ca. It would appear that George Bush Sr. not only inherited the proceeds of his father's Nazi collaborationist activities, he also inherited the approach of dealing with the official enemy. The documentary record reveals that the elder George Bush has had extensive dealings with the family of Osama bin Laden, public enemy number one after the 9/11 attacks. He was also connected to the same drug traffickers that he and his predecessors had pledged their nation to fight a war against. Professor Michelle Chosudovsky is an award-winning author, professor emeritus of economics at the University of Ottawa, and founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. He published and republished a number of articles detailing some of those connections. The Global Research News Hour had a chance to reach out to him on the same day of his state funeral to talk about some of those contacts.
George Herbert Walker Bush was meeting the brother of Osama bin Laden. His name is Shafiq bin Laden. And it was in the context, essentially, it was in the context of a meeting of the Carlyle Group. They met actually on the 10th as well as on the 11th. And the media actually never reported this until two years later. In other words, while the World Trade Center was under attack, the Carlyle business meeting at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel was ongoing with the brother of Osama bin Laden, Shafiq, and various other personalities, including Bush Sr., in other words, George Herbert Walker Bush. And, you know, any reasonable person would say, well, what on earth was the dad, Poppy, doing with Osama's brother, Shafiq, on September 10th and 11th, when the brother of Osama bin Laden, allegedly, was attacking the Pentagon, the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. And first of all, they didn't mention it. And then when they did cover it, they simply dismissed any kind of relationship between the two events. Okay, the dad of the sitting president of the United States was at the Ritz-Carlton with the brother of the terrorist who had attacked America, and it was not really a topic for the headlines. The whole thing was dismissed, and if we look at routine issues of land enforcement, we might ask, did the president not instruct the law enforcement communities, in other words, the FBI, who were investigating matters, to at least question Shafiq bin Laden and perhaps even question his dad? So that we have to ask those things, because there was no objective investigative reporting of what was happening at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. And I should mention that there was the former Secretary of Defense Frank Carlucci, and then the former Secretary of State James Baker were all there, and other members of the bin Laden family. And it simply didn't get reported whatsoever.
Professor Chosudovsky, you mentioned that this meeting took place under the auspices of the Carlyle Group. Could you maybe expand a little bit. I mean, what exactly is the Carlyle Group, and how are bin Laden and Bush connected?
Well, essentially, Carlyle Group is a big private equity conglomerate that manages billions of dollars. It manages the bin Laden family wealth. It manages various. I should say that the bin Laden family is linked to the Saudi monarchy. Okay, that's very important. But in other words, it was a business meeting. But there are too many coincidences. Why did it happen on the same day? Why were the bin Ladens there? And there was simply no police investigation or interrogation of Osama's brother-in-law. One would expect that at least Shafiq bin Laden and the president's dad might have been remanded in custody for questioning. It's a standard procedure, but it didn't happen. I think that what this indicates is that there are alliances between two very wealthy families, and it's also tied into to the history of Middle East geopolitics. It's the fact that Saudi Arabia supported Al Qaeda when they were first recruited in 1979 in the context of the Soviet-Afghan War. Al Qaeda, we know, is a creation of the CIA. And that, of course, that really is the forbidden truth. The fact that the so-called enemy of America, the number one enemy of America at the time, who was Osama bin Laden, had been recruited by the CIA with National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter, Zbigniew Brzezinski, playing a very key role in that whole agenda. And then the Saudi intelligence supported that endeavor. And the Saudi monarchy and the bin Laden family were financing. Now, people will say, and that's the official kind of narrative, they'll say, well, he's a black sheep in the family, okay? He's the bad guy, talking about Osama. But his brother Shafiq is okay. He's the business partner of the dad of the sitting president. Now, if people believe all that, I don't believe it. Well, at least we have to ask questions about these things.
Now, talking about family connections and that kind of, a bad apple argument, I mean, there are other associations. You pointed out in a recently republished article that the Bush family had ties with the Mexican drug cartels through the Salinas family. President Carlos Salinas was, he was the president of Mexico, but he had this, I guess, this black sheep brother, Raul, who was, and a father, it seems like there's a bit of a coincidence there as well in terms of the way the Bush family does things. And of course, you point out that Bush was well aware of Salinas's role in the Mexican drug trade. And true, Carlos was the president of Mexico. They had to deal with each other in order to broker a free trade agreement. But, could you speak a little bit more about any indications of the Bush family's interest in the Salinas family beyond what was required in a state-to-state relationship?
Well, I think that essentially that relationship was there ultimately to sustain the drug trade. We're talking about billions and billions of dollars behind that. And it's not strictly linked to a criminal cartel. It's a much broader process. But certainly George Herbert Walker Bush had personal ties with Carlos Salinas de Gortari, who actually is in Washington today, on Wednesday, for the funeral of George H.W. Bush. George H.W. Bush also had links to the father of of Carlos, who's called Raul Salinas Lozano. Raul Salinas Lozano was a leading figure in the narcotics unit, involving also the black sheep, Raul Salinas de Gortari. Now, and let me talk about the black sheep in the Bush family. It just so happens that Jeb Bush, who was governor of governor of the Sunshine State of Florida, and he was also presidential candidate in 2015 and eventually dropped out. But Jeb Bush had a very close personal relationship with Raul Salinas de Gortari, who was the brother of Mexico's former president, Carlos. And as we know, that Raul was considered to be the drug kingpin, and he was prosecuted and imprisoned in the wake of his brother's presidency. And at the same time, Carlos, who became president and who signed the North American Free Trade Agreement together with Mulroney and Bush Sr., well, in the wake of his presidency, he was framed and accused of having a link to the drug trade, and he went into exile to Ireland and then subsequently came back. And from what I understand, and that's very important, of course, for Canada and the United States, both Bush Sr. as well as Brian Mulroney must have been aware of the links of the Salinas presidency to organized crime. It was known in Mexico. And then this is interesting, because if you looked at some of the press reports in the 1990s, so the free trade agreement was signed in 1992. And I recall particularly the Texas and Florida media. They actually did cover it, particularly when Salinas de Gortari went into exile and Raul was imprisoned. And I'll read you the quote. The intelligence on corruption, especially the drug traffickers, has always been there. Okay. And that was a quote from a DEA official. But, quote, we were under instructions not to say anything negative about Mexico. It was a no-no, since NAFTA was a hot political football. A hot political football. Why? Because the president of the country who actually signed it is linked to organized crime. And that is something they knew, that something our government, Canadian government, knew, and the U.S. government knew as well. And they certainly didn't reveal it to public opinion. And then once NAFTA got signed, well, then, of course, both Raul and Carlos were framed. Carlos went into exile, and Raul was imprisoned. And he was subsequently freed and so on. So the Salinas de Gortari family is clean, as far as today's reality is concerned.
Well, Professor Chosudovsky, I mean, just to perhaps summarize, as Bush Sr. is being laid to rest, and there's a lot of laudatory commentary about him and his presidency being made in the mainstream media, I'm wondering if maybe I could give you a chance to provide your own assessment of Bush Sr.'s true role within the power establishment of the United States and what it says about that establishment.
Well, I think as an individual and a personality, he was an instrument of a much broader, complex process with dominant economic and financial interests. The drug trade today is a multi-billion-dollar undertaking. Organized crime is, in a sense, is also an instrument of that trade. Afghanistan produces more than 90% of the world's heroin, which is channeled illegally out of Afghanistan, which is occupied by the United States. Okay, so we're not going to change history with another dynasty. Okay, these individuals they obey orders. They personify a process, and we have to address the much broader process of what some people call the deep state, and the kind of evolution that we're facing today with the possibilities of war and destruction.
Joining me now with his reflections on the legacy of George Herbert Walker Bush is Stephen Lendman, a former host of the Global Research News Hour and of the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stephen has been writing on national and international issues since 2005. He's a 2008 Project Censored winner and recipient of the 2011 Mexican Journalists Award, International Journalism Award. He's also edited and contributed to the 2014 volume Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. Stephen Lendman, it's good to have you back on the Global Research News Hour.
Oh, Michael, thank you very much. It's great to be on with you.
Stephen, the crimes and misdemeanors of George Bush, Sr., during and even preceding his terms in the White House, are probably too numerous to count in the short time we have together. Listening to a lot of the press coverage, you'd think his greatest sin was that he didn't like broccoli. Late night talk show hosts are using the recent funeral as more ammunition against their favorite target, Donald Trump. Not that I'm a fan of Donald Trump, but at the same time, I think that we need to really, you know, get a proper perspective on this man's background. What are the items that you wish the press would mention as they recount Bush's record?
Well, there's no question that the Bush family, I mean Bush Senior, Bush One, I guess he's called, is really a crime family. I wrote an article about the Clintons a number of years ago, and I titled it the Clinton Crime Family. Well, I could write the same article about the Bush family, calling it the Bush Crime Family, and indeed it is. It goes back to the World War One era. It really goes back to the John D. Rockefeller era. So that's really around the turn of the 20th century. Back then and through World War One and all sorts of things from that period to the present day with no Bush in power right now. But I guess there are younger Bush generations. Who knows? There's Jeb Bush in Florida. Maybe some of the younger ones will come up and run for office and get elected. But the Bush family goes back many, many years. There's so much about them. It's just so odious, Michael.
No.
Back in the 1930s, early 1940s, the collaboration with Nazi Germany, Prescott Bush, with Brown Brothers Harriman, doing business with the Nazis. So did a lot of other U.S. corporations. Big names. Some of them were exposed. I think most of them got away with it. Nothing was done to them. Some of them were exposed. Brown Brothers Harriman had its assets seized. There was one other company I wrote about the same thing. I forget which one it was. But we had that going on. As far as Bush 1 goes, my goodness, I mean, his record as a congressman, CIA director, envoy to China, vice president and president. In a second article that I wrote, I talked about his war on Panama and, of course, the Gulf War in 1991. I mean, just horrific wars. Most people don't even realize that America went to war with Panama in 1989.
Yeah, Noriega.
I believe after that war, he used the expression that we finally managed to lick the Vietnam syndrome. Yeah, we sure as heck did, especially post 9/11. Mm. But the legacy of Bush 1 and, of course, Bush 2, the whole family, is pretty odious, Michael.
Yeah. I know that, one point that I think we really need to touch on is that there was the infamous Willie Horton ads, and that was a black prisoner who had been in the in Michael Dukakis's state. He had been in what was called a furlough program, and he was let out. And during that time, I mean, he had apparently killed someone and raped
a woman, and they showed these pictures of this violent-looking black man, and it was clearly a dog whistle to a lot of, you know, potential voters who had harbored some primordial fears about, you know, racist fears, but he triggered that sort of stuff. And that legacy has continued even through, you know, since then with the Clintons and, you know, using the super predator and, you know, concerns about crime and so on, and right up to Trump and, I mean, the things that he's, I mean, perhaps built on. But I think that's kind of a significant dimension of this, of his record.
Indeed, Michael. Of course, it's symptomatic of dirty politics in America. And I mean, not in America, of course. This stuff goes on in many, many countries. I think maybe politics and dirty belong in the same sentence, and nearly not 100% of the time, but very, very much a great deal of the time. And certainly in Western countries, I mean, you expect this kind of stuff in despotic countries. Of course, they don't need to pull these stunts in despotic countries. They have elections. Well, they call them elections, as we know, Michael. But and maybe somebody is put up against the ruling authority that automatically wins. Just to trickle a few votes, so a few percentage of votes to the opposition candidate to make it look like a legitimate election. I know this went on a couple of times in Egypt in the last 6, 8, 10 years or so. It's gone on in other countries. I mean, it went on when Mubarak was president of Egypt, and when also Sisi, the U.S. War College graduate, he did that, I believe, twice. Once, about a year or so ago, rigged an election to make certain that he won. And the easiest way is to be sure that nobody competing with the ruling authority that wants to stay the ruling authority stays in power. But again, it's dirty politics, and I guess it's as refined in America as any place else, Michael.
Well, I think that one very important point also is the Iran-Contra, you know, arms for hostages deal. He was a major architect of that whole dynamic, you know, happening under Reagan. And that's, you know, that certainly has ramifications even for today.
It sure did. And then Bush 1 pardoned the Iran-Contra villains, about half a dozen of them. Elliot Abrams was one. Most of the names are names people wouldn't recognize. A couple of them I had to scratch my head to see if I remember them. But I certainly remember Iran-Contra in the 80s. It's a devastating thing, and it really was. I mean, it went on in Nicaragua. That was Iran. That was Nicaragua, but the same kind of horrors went on in El Salvador and Guatemala, of course. Earlier, that Guatemala began back in the Eisenhower administration. But just awful stuff that goes on, and I mean, Bush 1 was up to his ears in this stuff. Again, his long career, beginning in Congress and continuing through his time as president. And it was kind of surprising that he didn't win a second term. I think it was because Ross Perot got into the race in 1992. Always even years. And Ross Perot, the only independent candidate who ever took a sizable percentage of the vote and swung the election to Bill Clinton. I don't remember the percentages, Michael. You may not either. Mm. But I don't think Clinton won a majority of the vote. But he won a plurality and became president. And I thought that was a relief to get somebody other than a Bush in power. I think probably turned out even worse than having Bush won.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I don't think we can let the Bush record go without mentioning the Persian Gulf War, and that was the first post-Cold War conflict, and, of course, that had devastating consequences. It was a war that needn't have happened. It was an illegal war. It was, you know, there was the sanctions that followed, and this is all part of Pappy Bush's large crusade to... Well, I guess to you know, like you just mentioned, knocking the Vietnam syndrome. But I find that it quite distressing that that initiating that war is been a feather in his cap when it should be something that he was condemned for.
Well, Noriega in Panama and Saddam in Iraq had one thing in common. They were former U.S. assets, very valued U.S. assets. until they forgot who was boss, something to that effect. And then America went after to get rid of both of them. And Saddam was sucked into a situation with Kuwait, a Kuwait cross-drilling, stealing Iraqi oil. Saddam tried to resolve it diplomatically. Repeated efforts failed. And this was a scheme to get him to become belligerent against Kuwait, which he did. He fell for the scheme. I don't think he was a dummy, but he certainly was not very smart in falling for the U.S. scheme, which is really what it was, to get him to be belligerent against Kuwait, to give the U.S. A reason to attack him and depose him. Well, he didn't. He wasn't deposed under Bush 1. That waited for Bush 2 to happen in 2003. Bush 1 didn't go to Baghdad. He was criticized for that, but Bush 2 took care of that. But he initiated the genocidal sanctions on Iraq, and that was maybe his greatest crime of all. And one of the U.N. Oil for Food representatives, U.N. Oil for Food representatives, two of them, one of them made the comment that these sanctions were responsible for killing 5,000 Iraqi children under age 5 every month while they were in force. This was Bush 1. Of all the crimes he committed, I can't think of any greater than that, Michael.
Now, one more point. I think that I'm sure you're familiar with this. When the Soviet Union folded, there were negotiations between the Americans and Gorbachev, and Gorbachev was left with the understanding, while Bush was in power, that there would be no further encroachment on towards Russia. And I think that very clearly did not happen. I mean, to what extent does Bush deserve criticism for allowing that encroachment to happen?
Well, the only criticism of Bush 1 on that, I don't know how genuine he was in negotiations, maybe more genuine than the current crop of people around today in America, but the encroachment toward Russia's borders did not begin on his watch. It began under the Clinton co-presidency, which is what it was, and then it accelerated later post 9/11, and literally crawling right up to Russia's borders. The two countries that are not incorporated into NATO, I mean, these countries are made NATO members. The only two that are not NATO members, important ones that border on Russia, are Ukraine and Georgia. And comments have been made by America and Ukraine that it's just a matter of time before America gets both of these countries into NATO. And this is a red line for Moscow. Putin, even in diplomatic language, has basically said that Russia simply won't stand for this. It wouldn't go to war over this, but it would certainly take a retaliatory action to protect itself, strengthen its border. The idea of both of these countries, again, the border and Russia, to have NATO troops stationed right along the border with Russia. That's an intolerable situation. If you could imagine Chinese or Russian or any other foreign troops stationed along the Canadian border or Mexican border with America, that would be a reason for war, for America to go to war with them. But this is what probably will happen in the future. Good Lord, I hope something happens, and it doesn't, Michael, but it seems that things continue to get worse, not better, in bilateral U.S. relations with Russia. But that would really be something that could be provocative enough to provoke confrontation between the two countries.
Okay. Just one last point, and maybe if you can make it in like about a minute or less. Does Bush, in your mind, like what distinguishes him from, because I mean, I think it's, you'd probably agree, I mean, virtually every president going back to Truman should have been hanged under Nuremberg for war crimes. But is there anything that distinguishes Bush Senior from the other presidents, or is it just like just another another pea in that pod of commanders and murderers in chief?
I think it's basically the same. Although I've made this point about U.S. regimes, each new one seems to exceed the worst of the previous one. It certainly has been true since the 1990s. Well, the Clintons absolutely were worse than Bush 1, and then the Bush-Cheney, Bush 2 and Cheney, worse than the Clintons, Obama worse than Bush-Cheney, and Trump worst of all. I mean, I just can't imagine what's going to happen with the next regime after Trump. World War III, Michael? Or maybe we'll get it while Trump is still in power.
Yeah, that's a concern. Stephen, thanks so much for your time.
Michael, thank you.
We've been speaking with Stephen Lendman, a writer, a journalist, and a past broadcaster. You can find his articles at the website stephenlendman.org.
We've come to the end of our program this week. Thank you for listening to this special presentation on the life and legacy of George Herbert Walker Bush on the Global Research NewsHour. Music this week was A New World by Purple Planet Music. Find this and other selections from the site purple-planet.com. The Global Research NewsHour airs weekly on radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is also podcast on the independent news site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. My name is Michael Welch. Please join us again next week and stay tuned for your next regularly scheduled program.